Judiciary Committee will come to order. Chair recognizes a quorum is present. Members, we have six bills on our agenda today. And I understand there's some stuff cooking on the stove for session tonight, too. But we have a room reserved for tonight. So depending on how it goes, we also have a room reserved for tomorrow night, Friday night. So for those of y'all who go out on the town Friday night, it'd be nice if we can get through as much as we can today so you don't have to be here tomorrow night. First bill on the agenda will be Representative Edelson's 331, tobacco. Next will be House File 203, Representative O'Neill, data sharing. Then House File 998, Representative Eklund. He will be back for that. And then I have three bills. Earn Sick and Safe Time, Legislative Commission on Intelligence. The plan is to adopt the Johnson Amendment and re-refer that to GovOps. And then location tracking for GPS or cell site location service. So keep that in mind if we can be as efficient about it as possible. Hopefully we won't have to be here tonight or tomorrow night, but we'll see about that. First order of business, approval of minutes of March 6th. Do I have a motion? Representative Barr moves the minutes of March 6th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes of March 6th are approved. The first item, Representative Edelson. Representative Mueller moves that House File 331 be recommended be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. We have the bill before us. Representative Edelson, you have an amendment. Is that right, the A11?
Yes, Chair, I do.
Okay. Representative Knorr moves the A11 amendment in order to get the bill in the shape the author so desires. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. So to your bill as amended, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. It is my honor and privilege to present House Bill 331 to you today. This bill would increase the age people can be sold tobacco products from 18 to 21. This idea is so popular, it's become a movement with the name Tobacco 21. I wanted to carry this bill because in May 2017, Edina, my own town, was the first local community to pass Tobacco 21 in Minnesota. I was very involved in the local effort, organizing community education sessions, engaging community members, and testifying to our city council on behalf of our Human Rights Commission. Since then, 22 other Minnesota cities and counties have followed Edina to protect youth in their communities as well. Nationally, seven states and over 400 cities and counties have also passed Tobacco 21. It's sweeping over every part of this country. I want to thank all the co-authors who have signed on so far, Democrats, Republicans, representatives from urban, suburban, and greater Minnesota communities. So far, this bill has been heard in HHS policy and the Commerce Committee, and I'm optimistic we'll move it through this committee today. These committees heard from nearly 20 testifiers from all walks of life who supported this bill. In contrast, I believe only two individuals testified in opposition, both from the tobacco or vape industry. We've heard compelling testimony from parents, physicians, local mayors, school principals, public health experts, teachers, and most notably, Minnesota students who came to the Capitol to tell their stories and ask for our help, legislators. This bill is supported also by JUUL, noting that they realize this public policy would benefit reducing youth usage. To respect the committee's time today, we don't have a lineup of testimony regarding the economic and health harms that come from tobacco use. Instead, we'll focus on the pieces germane to this committee. However, before I walk through my bill, I want to underscore that Minnesota's youth nicotine epidemic is real, and it's a serious health threat. Despite great progress, our adult tobacco prevalence rate has stalled, and last year, for the first time in a generation, we saw an increase of youth tobacco use, fueled by JUUL and other novel products that are attractive to kids. Today, one in four high schoolers have tried using tobacco products, one in four middle schoolers. We know that nicotine harms the developing brain, and no amount of nicotine is safe for our kids. Make no mistake, the tobacco industry has aggressively marketed to our kids. We cannot sit by and watch our kids develop lifetime addictions. It is time for us to stand up for our youth and our future. We know that Tobacco 21 will prevent youth tobacco use and save lives. The National Academy of Medicine's landmark study concluded that Tobacco 21 would have a considerable impact on delaying cigarette smoking. Tobacco 21 is one of the best tools we have for making that age of initiation higher. The Center for Disease and Control has recommended states pass Tobacco 21, and the U.S. Surgeon General estimates that 6 million children will die prematurely if this current trend continues. By raising the age, we can help remove tobacco products from our high schools and middle schools, and we can help protect teens and populations targeted by the tobacco industry, especially people of color, members of the military, LGBTQ people, and others. Most teens who use e-cigarettes get them from friends that are 18. There are very few 21-year-olds in high schools members. Tobacco 21 blocks Big Tobacco's pipeline into our schools. There's broad support for this movement, and Minnesota can join leading states by raising the age to 21 this year. Now, members, let's walk through the bill. Section 1 adds e-cigarettes and charter schools to the section pertaining to the use of tobacco in schools. Section 2 updates the definition of tobacco product shops to reflect the new age standard.
Representative Edelson?
Yes?
Just to clarify, I would like to limit it to what we're talking about in this committee, but I can't remember what that is right now.
Okay, so, sure. So we're it'll just be a few moments. I'm almost done. It's just a few more sections of the bill. So I think it's really going to be the
Well, I'd like you to walk through the sections that we're just going to consider. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So it's going to be I believe it'll be under Section 7. This will be a part which would the compliance checks essentially say the reporting requirement to approve accountability enforcement. The amendments provided the amendment provides more detail about what is required. So if members look over the amendment, I think that's actually germane to this committee. Also, let's go to the penalties. This bill removes penalties for underage use, possession, and purchase. So what we have done here is making it a petty misdemeanor instead of a misdemeanor for the first offense, a misdemeanor instead of a gross misdemeanor for the repeat violation within 5 years, and penalties remain for a person who gives underage person a fake ID. The licensing provisions increase administrative penalties on tobacco license holders, and so that would also be we're moving them in line with other states that have passed Tobacco 21. And I think those would be the areas that would be before the committee's consideration.
Well, if I may, Representative Edelson, if I could ask research, I thought we were talking about the administrative penalties. Is that kind of more the purview of the committee? Can research help clarify?
Chair and members, it would be within the jurisdiction of the committee to look at the civil penalties. I believe the sections that Representative Edelson just referred to relate to criminal penalties.
Okay. That was my concern, because you went through public safety on the criminal penalties on this. Isn't that right, Representative Edelson?
No. Chair, I had spoke with you, and then you said coming here would probably suffice.
Yes. I remember that now. Yeah. You got to forgive me. It's like, you know, deadline, so I don't really remember anything. But I do remember that now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. Criminal. So civil penalties and criminal penalties and... Okay. All right. Go ahead. Thanks.
Well, I think I covered that section, Chair. So I'm happy to move to my first testifier, because I know that
sure.
we're limited on timing here.
Chair, could I just ask the bill author, just to outline the line numbers of those different sections?
Oh.
But it was go so fast I couldn't.
Oh
follow.
Yeah. I apologize. Yes. One second here.
Representative Edelson.
So let's see here. Penalties. I believe it's section 11 or section 12. Okay. So what would be lines 8.10 through 8.13 would be before the committee's consideration. Lines 7.25 through 7.33. And then lines 9.28 through 9.32. And then I have more. I'll just wait a minute, though.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and testify or introduce yourself for the record. We could proceed on that. If we had other additions later, we could move to those. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Latricia Vitar, and I am the Health Policy and Advocacy Manager at North Point Health and Wellness Center. I also serve as a at-large commissioner on the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. I'm here today to talk about Tobacco 21. North Point is an active member of the Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation Coalition. We're a diverse statewide coalition that supports Representative Edelson's bill. Before I go on, I want to show you all some of the products that we're talking about here today. The product that I have, and I'll pass them around, the product that I have in my hand is the Juul, and so we'll pass that around. Juul is like a thumb drive, or it looks like an iPhone charger. It comes in flavors like mango, cucumber, and mint. Each pod contains as much nicotine as a whole pack of cigarettes. This is another similar e-cigarette. It's called the Soren. In schools, it's becoming very popular. This, my all-time favorite, is a vaping hoodie. And so, see? Always that reaction. That's why it's my favorite. So the strings have the vaping device in them. And so I'll pass these around. The strings are disguised as vaping tools. And so the last thing I'm going to hold up is Swisher Sweets. These are cheap flavored little cigars that are usually used frequently by the kids that I work with every day in North Minneapolis. I could talk all day about why Tobacco 21 and tobacco prevention in general is a health equity issue. My community and other marginalized groups have been targeted for generations by Big Tobacco. They advertise more in our neighborhoods and in our magazines. And, of course, I have some more visuals. This is going to be a visual morning. So this ad is from Marlboro. It's Marlboro targets people of color, including menthol. Oh, no, this one is the Virginia Slims. I'm sorry. This is the Virginia Slims ad, and it shows a beautiful black woman, and the brand is known for targeting women and urging women to find their voices. This one is from Juul. The Juul ads show how they target people of color through colorful, fun-looking ads. This vaporized campaign ran when the brand launched the blatantly targeted youth campaign. And here's the menthol ad from Marlboro.
Ms. If I could ask you, I know this is your third committee stop, right? And I know that you've been able to present this to other folks. We do, because of the number of bills we have on the committee calendar, I'd like you to restrict it just to those sections we talked about, if you could speak to those.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
So a recent national study found that there are up to 10 times more tobacco ads in black neighborhoods than other neighborhoods. They put menthol in cigarettes to hook us. They target us with cigars, cigarillos, chewing tobacco. As a result, many communities of color are more likely to suffer and die from tobacco-related disease. My life's work has been to stop this. Around the country, as Tobacco 21 movement has taken off, one lesson that we've learned early on is removing possession, use, and purchase penalties, often called PUP penalties, is key. There's a consensus among leading health groups, including the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, that Tobacco 21 laws should eliminate these penalties. Our coalition, Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation, adopted core principles when we started working on local Tobacco 21 policies, and eliminating PUP penalties was one of them. As we have seen the Tobacco 21 movement taking off in Minnesota, none of our Tobacco 21 communities has extended PUP penalties beyond state law, and most have eliminated these penalties entirely. We don't need the unintended consequences of increasing negative interactions between young people of color and law enforcement at the time we are trying to collaborate with law enforcement and build bridges between our communities. In fact, Okay. In fact, in many communities in Minnesota, police chiefs have been vocal supporters of removing pup penalties and don't want to be the smoking cops, nor do they want to send more kids down a criminal path. Pup laws are not proven to reduce youth tobacco use, and they unfairly stigmatize youth.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time. Is there another testifier?
No, Chair, but I was just going to give you the other lines, if that's helpful. Line 7.26 would be also in this committee's discretion. Lines 3.2 to 3.16. Lines 3.18 to 3.24. And lastly, line 7.17 through 7.19. And 9.4 to 9.10. And that is the chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. So from what I can see, it is essentially administrative penalties, civil penalties, the criminal penalties, and the use of false identification, creation of that statute, and then the deletion of the status as a petty misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
So if members could keep their comments restricted to those, the questions restricted to those, and then we have another testifier that's going to speak to those. Is that right?
No.
Opposition testifier.
Oh.
Okay.
Not my testifier, Chair.
No, but we'll do questions after that. So who's going to come down and say they don't like it? Or they have concerns? That's it. We have concerns. Right? Great. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony. Please keep testimony restricted to those sections that we pointed out.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Tom Bryant. I'm the executive director of two trade associations. First, the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association, which is a state wholesale trade association that sells tobacco products to retailers, and also the National Association of Tobacco Outlets, a national retail trade association with member stores in here in Minnesota. House File 331 removes any deterrent to possess and use tobacco products by anyone that's under the age of 21. The legislation does this by repealing the petty misdemeanor penalty for possessing or consuming tobacco. In other words, the bill essentially legalizes the possession and use of tobacco by anyone under 21, including anyone under the age of 18. If the goal of House File 331 is to discourage the use of tobacco by minors and 18, 19, and 20-year-old adults, the bill seems to do exactly the opposite. House File 331 would also repeal the current misdemeanor penalty if a person under the age of 21 were to use a false ID to attempt to purchase tobacco products, and they substitute alternative penalties such as tobacco-free classes and tobacco cessation classes. Last night I went online to kingoffakes.com. This is a website that will sell you a fake Minnesota driver's license. On the website it says, "Unlike many competitors, we have faked this driver's license perfectly, and we can say that this is an in-state passable ID. Our team has perfectly replicated the feel, bendability, and even the lenticular loons on the license. To be effective, a law needs a penalty to deter illegal activity and needs to be enforced. However, on the one hand, the solution that House File 331 attempts to impose is to triple and quadruple the monetary fines on retailers if they would sell a tobacco product to someone underage, even though they work very hard to prevent those sales, and on the other hand, would virtually eliminate any deterrent effect or criminal penalty of any kind if someone underage is resourceful enough to go out and buy a fake ID for $100 off of this website. We ask you not to support those provisions of the bill because it literally legalizes possession and use of tobacco by someone under the age of 21. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Bryant. There's Bruce Neustadt who's coming up too. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony. Please keep it restricted to those sections, those penalty sections talked about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bruce Neustadt. I work for the members of the Minnesota Retailers Association. Among those retailers are folks that legally sell tobacco products. I want to comment on two areas of the bill within the purview of the committee real quick. I want to be very clear in saying, though, my organization is neither for nor against this. Retailers' job is to enforce the law, and we do a pretty good job at that here in Minnesota. Mr. Bryan did mention administrative penalties, so I won't belabor that, but it would be our opinion that in the penalty area, today's existing penalties do a good job of striking a balance between recognizing when an honest mistake is made versus that of a kind of repeat offender or somebody who conscientiously disobeys the law. So we do prefer the existing administrative penalties that are in statute versus the ones in the House file. The other area, and I apologize to the author for not being able to mention this before, I just picked it up in the amendment. I noticed there is a provision that makes the list that's in the bill publicly available. And that is probably a little concerning to retailers as I think through it out loud. Just to give you a little context, a retail operation is going to have a policy, and the policy is going to conform with the law. So if this bill passes, that it would not sell to somebody under 21. It's going to have a process for ensuring that, for verifying an ID, and it's going to have a procedure in place to make sure that's done. So the procedure level largely rests with a human who has to verify based on the processes that are at its disposal. And what we see today, actually, a little bit on the local level is a lessening of accountability relative to the clerk. So we are concerned a little bit about the idea that there's a list that's publicly available, housed in one central spot, and the tensions that could innately cause between a clerk and the clerk's employers, again, as accountability is reduced for that clerk, but really accountability is heightened for the employer. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to provide a few comments today.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Newstead. Is there anyone else from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 331 as amended? Seeing none, we will go to member questions. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. The first is, what happens to those, actually I should, when is the enactment date of this?
Representative Edelson?
Let's see. It's August 1st, Chair.
Thank you. So then what happens to those who would be 18, so between 18 and under 21, at enactment of this? Would they be prohibited, or are they grandfathered in?
Representative Edelson.
Chair, no, they would not be grandfathered in. It would, the age would be 21.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, Mr. Chair, so somebody who's 20 years old, for example, could have been purchasing tobacco products for the last 2 years, and now all of a sudden is going to be made illegal. I have a concern with that. The next would be, when looking at line 9.28 through 9.32, it reads, no penalty shall apply to a person under the age of 21 years who purchases or attempts to purchase these products while under the direct supervision of a responsible adult for training, education, research, or enforcement purposes. Could you just expand on what that means?
Representative Edelson.
Chair, the goal is to not criminalize kids that have been targeted by an industry. I mean, honestly, very much targeted with flavoring, with all these gadgets. We've passed them around. We don't need to criminalize our kids for being targeted by an industry that we have not protected them from, Representative.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr.
And Representative Lucero, we've got a few more people on the list, so maybe get your point.
Okay, I'll ask this offline. I genuinely just don't understand what that means, but I'll ask the
Chair. It would be for a compliance check. A child or the person would not be responsible.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Edelson. I heard this bill in committee in HHS, but you know, we didn't talk about the penalty section there, and I do agree with the idea of limiting sales to those age 21 or older, so I'm supportive of the idea, but I am concerned about the section on penalties where we're taking away all responsibility from the child. I mean, that's concerning to me, because I think kids who are self-aware enough to go get a fake ID should have some responsibility for their actions, and I get that they're being targeted, and I'm appalled by it. I actually had some meetings with some of the Juul people in my office expressing deep concern about a lot of the things we saw in HHS that you passed around today. So I really agree that they're being targeted, and it's terrible. But on the other hand, if they're getting a fake ID, I think we should allow them to have some responsibility here, too. So if you could just speak to why you completely remove the penalties.
Representative Edelson.
Chair, this was a discussion that we went back and I've been working with Clearway Minnesota, and we went back and forth on this issue. I would love to hear Mrs. Mullahan and your response to this, because I think I shared my view that I don't believe in criminalizing kids that have been targeted by an industry. But Mrs. Mullahan, do you have anything else to add?
Mullahan, do you want to speak to this? You bet. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Molly Moylan with Clearway, Minnesota. Thanks for the question, Representative. Again, as we have learned from other states who have enacted and moved forward with Tobacco 21, removing penalties for underage purchase, use, and possession is really critical, and there is national consensus around this, especially as we want to bring communities of color to the table. And this is a time where we don't need to increase interactions between young people in color and law enforcement, frankly. And so we've also learned through research that these penalties actually don't deter youth use. So if they were working, it'd be one thing, but we have data that shows they're not even a good deterrent. There are other good deterrents. So schools will absolutely be able to keep their penalties and their process in place, but this just removes the criminal path. This doesn't say what we want or need underage kids to use. This will definitely make it harder to access, but it just removes the criminal path.
Representative Rounds.
Thank you. So is there any penalty still for having a fake ID?
I guess House Speaker can speak to that. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, there is. Under Section 171.22, it is generally a misdemeanor to possess a false identification. There are a few gross misdemeanor penalties related to that that are not likely to be triggered under this scenario.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rembers. Representative, or Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, a couple of the topics have already been talked about, but I do have some concern on Section 9.4 to the 9.10, where it changes it from a penalty to a misdemeanor. You talk about the children, and I agree, we shouldn't penalize children. We should work with them. But 18 to 21, it's not children, they're adults. Mm-hmm. They're making a conscious decision. We allow them to vote. We allow them to be in our military. If they're going to not follow the law, I think we shouldn't have that as a petty misdemeanor, because they're probably the ones with the phony IDs that are actually purchasing it for the kids. We need... I think you do need to really look at taking petty out of there and changing it from 18 to 21. And under 18, yes, I don't have a problem with that. But these are adults that are making a decision. We went through the same issue with the alcohol when you went from 18 to 19, then 19 to 21 with the alcohol. And there again, with that, we grandfathered those in, because we were taking something that was legal for them and legal for everybody else, and it was going to make it illegal. It's not the right thing to do. The right thing would be to grandfather them in. Also on 9.23 to 9.32, use of false identification, that's a serious issue. As it was noted by that person, false IDs are readily available. We need to crack down on them because they're used for more than just a tobacco. They could be used for multiple different issues. That's why law enforcement does, when we find them, we do crack down, and it's important to that we take them away and get them out of circulation and make it a deterrent to have these false identifications, because with the false identification that are available, they're also stealing your ID, which is we have a huge issue with identity theft. And I can't remember if it's in here or public safety. We have a bill up today dealing with expunging the records of those who were victims of identity theft. By allowing false IDs, you're allowing false identity, and we need to really crack down on that. Then one other thing. We need to have our federal government do their duty. From 1995 to 2016, they subsidized the tobacco industry with $567 million. and that's the tobacco farmers. We need to phase them out. In 2017, they had a bill to stop the subsidies of tobacco farmers that's growing the tobacco, but that died in committee. So I think everybody out here should be contacting not just their legislator, their senator and their congressional, but all of them and start doing the crackdown there.
Chair Scott.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Johnson took some of my questions, but so that boils me down to one question that I have, and that is for the guest testifier. I'm just wondering what your organization's position is on legalization of marijuana.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Clery, Minnesota has a court-ordered mission to focus on tobacco prevention. We can't have a position on legalization of marijuana.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lucero, you had un poco question.
It'll be super even faster than I initially thought. Good. Because Chair Scott just took it. I was just going to mention there are a number of handouts here from tobacco-related organizations, and I was curious what their positions might be as well on marijuana, and if they're in favor of it, are they looking to have 21 or 18?
Wait, you're – okay. So, Representative Lucero, you're asking for the opposition testifiers to come down? Who do you
– No. Let me clarify, Mr. Chair. It was more of a rhetorical question that could be answered offline by these groups.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, I don't see any other questions from the committee. So, Representative Carlson. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on some of the comments that are made, you know, the city of Bloomington adopted this ordinance years ago, and a lot of the concerns that have been raised are just not haven't been my experience or the city of Bloomington's experience. So I don't know if the bill author wants to speak from an Edina perspective on this, but it just hasn't panned out to some of the fears that have been brought up. So it's been a good program, and hopefully we can bring this statewide.
Okay. Thank you. Who made the motion on this? Representative Noor moved that House File 331, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion passes. You are on your way. Thank you, Representative Engelson.
Mr. Chair, real quick. Thank you. I noticed that this does have some penalties that are criminal penalties. So will this be going to public safety, and then will it also be going to GovOps, because I think it has rulemaking in it?
Well, Chair Scott, I don't know where it's going next. I do know that part of the deal, reason we talked about penalties in this committee is because we talked about the criminal penalties, so I don't expect we're going to be going to public safety. But go ahead, Representative Edelson, do you want to
speak? Chair, I spoke with Chair Freiberg, and he said it does not have to go to GovOps.
Okay.
Representative.
Chair Johnson.
There's also, just wondering if this bill also needs to go to transportation, because it also has 171, the driver's license issues in it.
Okay. So, members, I don't know what chairs are going to ask for it or what path leadership is going to decide needs to go. I'm sure if you guys have beefs with it not meeting certain jurisdictional areas, you'll probably bring that up on the floor, but I don't really consider it my... bailiwick. So, the next bill on the calendar, Representative O'Neill, House File 203, data sharing permitted to administer the disabled veterans homestead market value exclusion. Representative O'Neill, I move that House File 203 be recommended to be re-referred to the Tax Committee. And we have the bill before us. And why is it before us, Representative O'Neill?
Data sharing. Unless that's a very good question.
Data sharing.
The majority of the bill actually has to do with data sharing.
Excellent. Thank
sharing
you.
Sharing of private data. So I'm going to be very brief because I have a testifier that's come from pretty far away, and so I'm going to let him talk about the majority of the bill. But in short, members, this bill was vetted last time around, and it was agreed upon. It was in the large bill that went to the governor. Unfortunately, it was vetoed. And this is a data sharing provision. Specifically, House File 203 allows the county veterans service officer to share necessary private data
with the county assessor for the sole purpose of determining disabled veterans or surviving spouse eligibility for the homestead market value exclusion. And with that, I'm going to let the testifier talk about how it's worked so far and why they need this additional change.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Chairman, members, my name is Christopher Hinton. I'm a County Veteran Service Officer for Waseca County in southern Minnesota. I'm also the legislative representative for the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers. I'm here to testify about House File 203. The bill came about because there was some language in there, in the original bill, that prohibited our offices, our departments, from talking to each other because of data privacy laws. My office, I have privileged access to VA systems. I don't get to see every veteran that's out there. However, I can see the ones that I am allowed to work with. The VA uses Social Security numbers to identify their veterans. That's how all the claims work now, and that's considered private data. When trying to talk with the assessors also have the same issue. They can't give out private information either. This bill will help us do that. It'll allow our departments to talk to each other, to go back and forth so that we don't have to have the veteran come back in with a release of information form every single year in order for us to talk to each other. The other thing that it caused was a sheer tremendous amount of work for the veteran service officers' departments specifically. In order to process each veteran, we got to find out who they are, what their disability rating is, find out if it's a surviving spouse case. If it is, do they qualify through several different ways.
And Mr.
For counties that, oh, yes.
I'm going to stop you for a second. So this sounds to me like a very common sense bill.
I agree.
Don't imagine there's much opposition testimony. Let me ask you this. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify against this? Like, is Min Koji here in objection to this or the anybody? I think you had me at hello.
Good.
And I'm wondering, you know, like, maybe we don't have to. I mean, you're not a lawyer. You don't get paid by the word, right?
Sure, but, no.
I mean, Is anyone object to just kind of sending them on their way? I think most people, does the committee understand the bill allowing for the sharing? Okay. Does anyone have any objection to expediting it? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. After all that, I kind of hesitate.
Well, don't hesitate. I'm serious. Bring it up. If I'm missing something, please.
Well, thank you. And I mean, I'm not familiar with this, and obviously, you know, some other members are, but I just, you know, the only possible objection to it, I suppose, would be if the veteran might feel that something's being shared without his or her knowledge and, you know, and consent. And it could, I mean, is there, could you explain, is this where the veterans asked for the benefit? And so when they're asking for it, are they being given information that this will, that to get the benefit will require some sharing of data?
Mr. Hinton.
So, yes, that is, you're on the right track there. The veteran comes to our offices and requests this benefit for them. So it's not like we're willy-nilly grabbing their stuff and handing it out to people to say, hey, does this person qualify or not? That's not the way it works. They have to come to us, apply for it, and then knowing that we'll be able to talk to each other and pass that through to get them qualified for it and to re-qualify it every single year.
Okay. Representative Barr. Oh, yeah, another Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there a note, so is there some way that we can be assured that they're notified that doing this means that there will be a sharing of their data? I mean, that's my only concern. I don't know that people really understand. I mean, maybe it's a, you know, not that serious an issue, but, you know, I guess that's just always my concern. You know, even if we say they don't have to come and sign a consent every year, do they understand that by asking for this, they're essentially giving permission to have their data shared?
Mr. Hinton?
The one thing with that, I would say, is that the assessor's office is in the county, and my office is in the county. We're both departments within the county itself. This information is not going out into the public. It's going between two secure offices that the information doesn't get anywhere but there.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think he answered my question. You know, I mean, I get it. This might not be the world's biggest data share. It might be, you know, not of concern generally. But I think that, you know, I just like to make sure that people at least they're implicitly consenting to having their data shared when it otherwise would not be. And I mean, you're not really telling me that they do understand it. That's my question. Do they understand that when they're applying?
Mr. Hinton.
When I speak to them, I always bring that up.
Okay.
I tell them that in order for me to qualify you and for the assessor's office to qualify you, then this is what has to happen. I cannot speak to every CVSO within the state, but that is typically how it's done.
Mr. Hinton, just to give you a background of why we're all hung up on this, is this the kind of thing we deal with year after year? And typically for information disclosure and privacy, there is in statute for many of these voluntary disclosures what's called a Tennyson warning, whereby you can waive your rights to the privacy of your data. And the purpose of that with respect to medical disclosures, whatever, is so that they know that, hey, by the way, the cat's out the bag on this. Is you tell them, but is that required by statute or required by your procedures or required by your job to tell them that this is going to be out there?
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Neal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling, for bringing that forward. And, of course, we want to make sure that people know that data will be shared in that very, very narrow exclusion. And I'm totally willing to come up with a small amendment where we can kind of do belts and suspenders to make sure that happens. I have no problem with that at all. We do have another step in taxes, and I could, even though it's not related to taxes, it's related to here, but I can bring that forward in taxes and make sure that is taken care of. It's really just a simple notice, and we can definitely add that so the CVO does notice to the veteran to make sure that they're aware that data will be shared in that very narrow situation. Thank you, Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hold on a second. Mr. Hopkins wants to speak to that. Go ahead, Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair and members, so under current law, whenever a government entity asks an individual to supply private or confidential data, they have to give a Tennyson warning to that individual. Part of that Tennyson warning is that they have to inform the individual of the identity of other persons or government entities authorized by law to receive the data. So when a person applies for this homestead exemption, they do give certain private data to the county assessor. So they would get a Tennyson warning under current law. They should get a Tennyson warning that would inform them of the identity of other persons authorized to receive the data. So if a county veteran service officer, if this bill passes, is authorized to receive that data, that would be included in the Tennyson warning that they get when they initially give the private information out.
All right. Great. Thank you. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, for those of us that served in the military, we signed away most of our privacy rights today, and we understood that we have had most of our information shared multiple times with multiple places and agencies that we never even dreamed of.
Representative
Considine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say thank you. My brother's widow has some health problems, and this, frankly, will make life easier for her. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments on House File 203? I moved it. You should have moved it since you're on the committee. But
thank you for moving it, Mr. Chair.
I moved it. So the motion is that it be recommended to be referred to taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. You are on your way to taxes. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Hinton and Representative O'Neill. House File 998, Representative Eklund. So House File 998, sentencing veterans for criminal offenses related to service-related disorder. So we have a motion for House File 998. The motion is to be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the is that right?
Well, I don't know.
Representative Eklund, where's this going?
Mr. Chairman, we were really hoping it would be sent back to veterans.
Okay. Let's have that motion now be have it be sent to Veterans Affairs, and then figure it out through testimony. Okay, we have the bill before us. Chair Considine?
Can I move it?
Committee. Yeah, go ahead. Representative Considine moves the bill that it be recommended to be referred to Veterans Affairs. Representative Eklund, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And there's an amendment to the bill that, to get it in the order that we'd like it to be.
Okay. Your amendment is numbered what?
A19-0090, Mr.
Okay,
Chairman.
Okay, tell us about the amendment. One moment. Oh, this needs to go back to Ways and Means.
Okay.
Okay, so
modify
my motion to reconsider.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Moves to reconsider the motion that it goes to Veterans Affairs. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Okay, now the motion, Chair Considine moves that it be re-referred to Ways and Means. Okay, we got this right now. You don't have an amendment, Representative Eklund?
I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair.
We ain't got one. What's your amendment do?
The amendment is on behalf of the county attorneys. The amendment clarifies that this bill applies to a misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor offense as well as felonies. It also addresses a concern raised by County Attorneys Association that bill may be abused by some veterans to avoid a conviction through this process. The amendment gives a judge authority to sentence outside this process if a veteran already receives a stay, received a stay of ab. I'm not an adjudication. I'm not an attorney, but anyway, on a felony.
It's five syllables, so you don't have to use that word.
Yeah. The court will retain the ability to use this process if appropriate, but will not be required under the bill.
Okay, so it sounds like it's squarely within the purview of this committee, so we should consider it, but I don't know. We don't have a copy of it either. Can we get a copy and see if we can waive the notice requirement and then maybe hear more about it? Chair Scott?
Mr. Chair, I think on this bill we'd be willing, if we want to take this up this evening, if they get an amendment by that time, we'd be willing to, you know, if you want to waive that time okay. frame for amendments, we'd be fine with that.
Maybe we could do that, because it sounds like it's an important amendment.
It is, Mr. Chair, and I thought we made the deadline. I apologize for that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, it's deadline, so that week, so things slip through the cracks, I guess. Why don't we move to the rest of the bill right now and speak to that, and then when we get the copy of that, we can see what we can do about sinking our teeth in it. So I don't know whose job it is right now to go up and make copies of the amendment, but whosever job it is, please go do that. Okay, Representative Eklund. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I apologize for the mix-up on the amendment. The bill before you, the Veterans Restorative Act, Justice Act, provides a framework for Minnesota courts on sentencing a justice-involved veteran, which will ensure treatment for service-related disorders that lead to a criminal offense, while allowing the veteran the opportunity to fully reintegrate with the community without a record of conviction. It is not a free ride, as the veteran defendant will be required to submit to whatever rehabilitative efforts the court deems necessary to protect public safety. The language was developed through an 18-month collaboration of key Minnesota veterans criminal justice stakeholders. It adapts and improves on the best practices from Minnesota's and other states' veterans courts and veteran sentencing statutes, including California Penal Code 1170.9, Texas Government of Code Chapter 124, and existing drug sentencing options, Minnesota Statute 152.18. I have with me some testifiers, and I would like to turn it over to them for the remainder of the presentation, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Okay, great. Thank you, Representative. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Lesh, members of the committee. My name is Brock Hunter. I'm an attorney, a veteran, and a co-founder of the Veterans Defense Project, a nonprofit public policy advocacy and education organization dedicated to ensuring that no veteran is left behind in the criminal justice system. Today, we face a growing storm of veterans flooding into the criminal justice system. After 17 years of continuous war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, the longest wars in our country's history, our military is under unprecedented strain. The vast majority of Vietnam veterans served only one combat tour, and government statistics confirm they struggled with high rates of post-traumatic stress and criminal justice involvement. Many in this current generation have served many more deployments. Two and three combat tours are now commonplace, and Marko Milosevic, who will be testifying after me, served 12 combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he will tell you he is not unusual. These unprecedented deployments are translating into higher rates of combat trauma and criminal justice involvement for this generation of veterans than in those in other conflicts. 10 years ago, in 2008, we worked with Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman and his Chief Deputy David Brown and others to draft and pass Minnesota's original veteran sentencing statute, one of the first of its kind in the nation. Our pioneering statute, which encourages treatment over incarceration for veterans whose criminal offense is tied to their service-connected disabilities, has had a national impact on the veterans' criminal justice landscape. It served as a model for similar statutes in other states and was even cited by the U.S. Supreme Court in the landmark decision that helped launch the National Veterans Court movement. While Minnesota started out on the cutting edge of this national movement, however, in the past years, we have fallen behind. While we are no doubt still doing good things for veterans in Minnesota, our 12 veterans courts serve only a fraction of our 87 counties, and they use a variety of different models, some of them more effective than others. Some of our veterans courts have even been shrinking at the time that the veterans coming into our system is growing. The main reason for this is that while some veterans courts are providing participants the opportunity to avoid a criminal conviction, others are not and are convicting veterans of their crimes even if they do everything that's expected of them. Bill Ward, the state public defender, even pulled his public defenders from all across Minnesota out of Minnesota's veterans courts in 2017 over concerns for the lack of legal benefits these courts were providing to the veterans involved. Meanwhile, across the country, other states now have many much larger numbers of veterans courts, and our once pioneering statute has been surpassed by states like Texas and California that have recently passed more sophisticated statutes that harness the hard-won lessons learned over the past decade on the front lines of working with veterans in the justice system. The bill before you, the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, is effectively version 2.0 of our original veteran sentencing statute, addressing the limited reach and disparate approaches in our current veterans courts and promising to bring the state's public defenders back into the process. This bill is the product of an 18-month intense collaboration among Minnesota's key veterans justice stakeholders, including Mike Freeman and David Brown from Hennepin County, John Choi, the Ramsey County attorney, Pete Orpett, the Washington County attorney, Bill Ward, the state defender, and Ben Johnson from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, among several others. The bill creates a framework based on proven best practices that all Minnesota judges, whether their jurisdiction has a veterans court or not, can put to immediate use to effectively deal with the veterans appearing before them. The bill provides eligible veterans the opportunity to avoid a criminal conviction. To be eligible, veterans must be charged with offenses that are not presumptive commits to prison, and they must demonstrate a nexus between a diagnosed mental health or substance abuse condition and their military service. Upon acceptance, veterans must enter a guilty plea and take responsibility for themselves and their recovery by staying sober and abiding by all treatment recommendations. The bill provides for a hearing at the end of the process for judges to hear from the prosecutors and victims, if any, to determine whether the veteran has done everything expected of them, and if the court determines that the veterans have held up their end of the bargain and it is in the interest of public safety, the court may dismiss the charge and the veterans would emerge with no criminal record. This approach works because it recognizes the service and sacrifice of our veterans on behalf of their communities. It incentivizes veterans' commitment to get what is often difficult, challenging treatment. And it offers them hope and redemption, and the ability for veterans to once again be assets and not ongoing liabilities to the communities they risk their lives to protect. And finally, it better protects public safety in both the short and the long term. This bill, if signed into law, will put Minnesota back on the cutting edge nationally and will ensure we leave no veteran behind in the criminal justice system. And with that, I'd like to introduce the next testifier, Marko Milosevic. Marko served, as I said, 12 combat tours as an Army Ranger and Special Operations soldier in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Marko came out with severe post-traumatic stress and other related conditions and shortly thereafter found himself in the criminal justice system facing a felony domestic assault in a county that had no veterans court. What we worked out for Marco in his case over the period of a year is a framework that looks just like this bill. Marco got help and was held accountable, and the prosecutor and the judge ultimately agreed to a stay of adjudication that allowed Marco to keep his record clear. Marco has made the most of the second chance he has been given in life, and he's here to tell you about that.
Mr. Milosevic, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to see you again, by the way. My name is Marco Milosevic, and I am here to share a little bit about myself and why this is important. So as Brock said, I joined the military in April of 2001. I was just going to do my 4 years and get my college money and get out. But while I was learning how to jump out of perfectly good airplanes, 9/11 happened. And as when 9/11 happened, the whole world changed. And a recruiter from the 75th Ranger Regiment came down, and I was an 18-year-old kid at the time, and he asked, "Who wants to go to war?" And I raised my hand because I felt it was my duty to go and serve my country. While I was in Ranger Battalion, like Brock said, I did 12 deployments. Those deployments had a very specific purpose. Our job was to kill or capture high-value targets. And in doing that, I did see a lot of combat, a lot of intense combat. As a matter of fact, the first time I met Chair Lesh, we were at a Medal of Honor convention in Minneapolis a few years back, and I was a guest of one of the recipients there. I was squad leaders with Master Sergeant Leroy Petrie, who is a living Congressional Medal of Honor recipient. And I only bring that stuff up because I just want to try to explain to you sort of the intensity of some of the combat we saw. It was very intense. And every time I came home from one of those deployments, I felt a less and less a part of this world. I saw the world in black and white, and I had one tool in my toolbox to solve my problems, and that tool was violence. And obviously, after my 12 combat deployments, I went to get out of the military. I'm 100% permanent and total disabled veteran due to physical injuries along with post-traumatic stress and TBI. And after all that time serving in my country's military, I got an American flag, a handshake, and a pat on the back. And I was pretty disillusioned. Initially, I fell in with the wrong crowd. I started drinking quite a bit, doing drugs, and running around with motorcycle clubs and all those sort of people. And eventually it led to what happened, my incident with my wife. We're still currently married, and now actually we talk to a lot of veterans and couples that are going through domestic violence-related issues, specifically as it pertains to combat service. And since I've gotten my second chance from the court, what I've done is still going to school. Last time we spoke, but this close to finishing my communications degree, and then I have aspirations of going on to William Mitchell Law School. And on top of that, I'm been able to stay a part of my family's lives. I still coach my son's hockey team. I'm an active member of the community, both the American Legion and the VFW in Forest Lake, Minnesota, where I live. And all these things wouldn't have been available to me if I didn't get a second chance. And I often talk to judges and sheriffs and prosecutors quite frequently, and I ask them if they've ever thanked a veteran for their service. And without hesitation, they always say yes. And I then say to them, here's an opportunity to really thank a veteran for their service and give them a second chance that they deserve since they fought for this country. And we sent them to war, and we asked them to do what they had to do, and now they've come home, and they deserve a second chance. And with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming before the committee and testifying, Mr. Milosevic, on behalf of the committee and the legislature. We thank you for the service you put in, and you know it is true that a lot of folks with the single-digit percentages that we have that Roger up. It's difficult to understand for a lot of us,
right?
What you have to go through. When you had 20% of the nation wearing the uniform at some point after World War II,
right?
Everyone got together and drank at VFWs afterward and talked through it. And we don't have that opportunities now. And
it obviously didn't result in, you know, great therapy either, drinking
no.
therapy. But
no, it does not.
But it was still, you know, there were still more people who could understand it. And with right. fewer people who can understand it now of what we train folks to do. If any of you have never read the book, I encourage you to read a book by an Army psychologist called On Killing. Mm. A lot of folks in the veteran community have read it, and it's remarkable, demarcating the differences between what we've trained our service members to do between wars of this nation's history and what we've done to change since Vietnam. And we've certainly made our service members more lethal, absolutely. And when you're talking about war, that's a good thing. But we also have more things that they end up having to deal with when they come back, and that's something we have not appreciated and had to consider. So thank you for being on the front lines of that, both abroad and at home.
Absolutely.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank
and
you.
It is really, and as the chair says, we really appreciate your service and appreciate how difficult it is to reenter, and I've met others as well. In everything the chair says, I absolutely agree with. I just have a couple of probably minor concerns about the way the bill is, and I just would like to ask about that, Mr. Chair, if it's okay. So one is, I was just as I'm reading through this on line 2.21. And let me just say, too, I want to just back up and say I like the approach of this. I really do, because I think that the recognition that people, we as a whole, not just for veterans, but across the board, are getting much more understanding of the result of trauma and how trauma really impacts people. And to get away from this kind of, oh, you did something bad, therefore you must be a bad person, and to understanding kind of what goes into this and treating people not as though they need punishment, but in the treatment mode. And I really like that approach generally, and especially here I totally see this for veterans. On the lines that start with 2.21, it has, as a condition of probation, the court may order the defendant to attend a treatment program for a period not to exceed the period which the defendant would have served if they'd been sentenced to jail or prison. I'm a little concerned about that, only because it equates treatment and the time in treatment to a time of punishment. And I just want to kind of flag that. Maybe I don't even know if this is the right committee to flag it in, frankly, but just... I just think that, you know, if we're going to treat people, often people need more treatment. Treatment isn't something that you can say, oh, I'm giving you the 20 days of treatment, and because that's all you would have been in jail, that you're now treated. It just creates a bit of a concern for me there. So that is one thing. And then the other thing I just wanted to raise is, and again, you know, like looking at the very next section, sub F there, 2.26, the defendant granted probation shall earn sentence credits for the actual time the defendant serves in residential treatment. I have no problem with that. I think that makes a lot of sense, but I don't think we treat other people that way. And I know that this bill is about veterans, and that's fine. But it does raise a concern for me whether there might be an equal protection argument from somebody else who doesn't get this benefit. And I don't know if that's a realistic concern or not. I mean, I'd like, you know, I think it's great to start with veterans for this. I hope we could... You know, there are a lot of ways people do get trauma, and I don't mean to equate that with what this gentleman's been through at all, but, you know, you could have a firefighter, a police officer, a person who, you know, who knows. There are other ways that people get exposed to severe trauma that can impact them, and I just do worry that, I'd like us to all to move in this direction, frankly. Yeah. I really would, and if this is an opening to that, I'm all for it anyway, but... I just wanted to express that concern, whether that does open up an equal protection challenge from someone else who says, wait a minute, the law says if I was a veteran, I'd get this. Why don't I get this, too?
So I'm going to ask a question I should know the answer to. for some reason slipping my mind now, isn't equal protection limited to designations of protected class? I mean, someone smarter than me tell me this. I mean, veterans are not a protected class. Well, I'm just saying under the equal protection terms. But I don't know. Maybe that's...
No, I don't think so.
Mr. Johnson or Ms. Mullen?
Mr. Chair and members, the Equal Protection Clause is not necessarily limited to those in a protected class, but the standard of review, whether it be regular scrutiny or strict scrutiny, will depend on whether or not it is aimed or targeted at or disproportionately affects a protected class.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, you're right. Were you done with your questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know if the testifiers wanted to respond, at least to the part about that length of time for treatment being the same as, if that's even appropriate here. It's up to you, Mr. Chair.
I wanted to speak to that. I would say this. I think because of the amendment, we're going to be coming back to, so if we need to get answers later, we can. Mr. Hunter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I can quickly address it. That specific language that you're referring to comes from the California statute, which is, I would say, currently considered the state of the art in the country. I think what we want to do is give the courts the latitude to order any amount of treatment that is recommended by the VA or other providers, but providing the parameters within which that are sort of modeled to the level of the offense. With respect to the equal protection argument, I guess I don't think veterans courts in this approach is much different than a drug court or a mental health court where you are addressing underlying diagnosed issues. And I think across the country and other states where this equal protection argument has been raised, it has been decided in favor of veterans courts, indicating that they really are no different than other courts that are addressing an underlying condition rather than punishing a specific behavior. And I believe the ACLU initially expressed those types of concerns and has since decided that this does not raise any objections with them.
Okay. Well, Mr. Sure. Chair, I guess I think the way the ACLU thinks, then, because I just, but I, you know, I, it's not that the separate court, but I don't know, maybe it's just something to keep our eye on for the future, because it isn't the fact that there's a separate veterans court. It's that, you know, there is an allowance in here in the language for people to actually be treated differently in terms of sentencing based on their status as a veteran. And I don't know, if I was a firefighter and I was in that situation, I might say, hey, wait a minute. You know, I should have that too. So.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's more of a comment. It's a national disgrace that we spend so much money getting soldiers ready to become lethal and spend so little time and resources in helping them transition back into the community. It should be equal, if not more, in bringing them back all the way. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Considine. Chair Scott. Johnson, sorry. Johnson first.
Chair Lesh, members, in reference to what Representative Liebling was talking about in 2.26 to 2.28, got to remember, if an inmate is in the jail or prison, they're sent to a treatment facility, they do get credit right now unless they've been furloughed out of the facility.
Good.
So if they haven't been furloughed, they do get the credit.
Yeah. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a question on line 3.22. It says the defendant, this is the terms for restorative justice and dismissal of charges. The defendant is in substantial compliance with the conditions of that probation. And I'm just wondering if you could kind of give us a better idea of what substantial means here versus full compliance, I guess.
Oh, Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess that is a word that would be left to the discretion of the judge. We understand that in this process, sometimes veterans will stumble and have issues. And throughout the veterans court movement, I think there's a recognition that this process sometimes is a bumpy road. And as long as the veteran takes accountability for their mistakes and deals with any recommended treatment that comes out of this additional stumble, sometimes they're required to do community work service and other things when they have, say, a positive UA along the way. Rather than getting kicked out of the program, as long as they're still willing to be held accountable and pay the price for their mistake and continue on with the program, we allow them to do so. So I think substantial compliance is just recognizing that they may not be pitch perfect all the way through, but as long as at the end of the process they have accomplished the goals that have been set out before them, the judge then has the discretion to allow them to move forward without that conviction.
Mr. Chair, just one other question. Is there a fiscal note to this? And this would be the committee, right? Because wouldn't it be the courts would be?
Well, it is courts, but it's also veterans. So this, yeah. in a normal situation, this would be, yeah, just veterans, or just the Judiciary Committee.
Right.
But because it's also veterans, it's in Veterans Committee, too, and I believe that would be where that would be the spreadsheet it would sit on. But okay. Representative Eklund, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. There is also a bill that's following this that provides funding for it. Representative Zhang is following it. We've heard that in the committee, and I believe that has been referred. I'm not sure where it got referred to, but it's moving along.
All right.
Also,
thank you.
Okay. Other questions? I think what we're going to do is we're going to hit pause.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. We do have two other testifiers.
Okay.
Here.
Yeah. Bring them up. Let's get them. Who are? Let me ask this. Is there anyone here who's testifying in opposition to this bill? Is there anyone here, in addition to the folks who are sitting up here now, who want to test in favor of it? Raise your hand. Oh, it's Mr. Ward. Okay. I groaned before I saw your face. Sorry. trying to, you know. Okay. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Orpett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Pete Orpett. I'm the Washington County Attorney. I've been a prosecutor for 31 years. I also served in the United States Marine Corps from 1973 to 76. I'm here to talk about this bill. And prior to this bill being drafted, I've been working for many years with Brock Hunter trying to make a difference for the veterans whom I'd see coming into our courts. And what struck me in the mid-2000s is many veterans started coming into felony court when I was in Hennepin County, and their record was stellar prior to going into service, while they were in the service. And it led me to ask, what happened? Well, when you look into their service record, it was obvious. Several tours of combat results in problems. And were we there to help? No, the unemployment rate for veterans at that time, and it's still high, was 25%. So we started working on that. When I became the Washington County Attorney, I set up a Veterans Protocol Program. I can tell you I've seen miracles. I've seen 42 miracles. And I call them miracles because these people, this isn't a two-tier justice system we're talking about. These guys and gals did not go in the service as criminals or miscreants. And but for that service, I'd never see them in a criminal court. And I say gals because I've had two women who are subject to military sexual trauma, who display the same problems of PTSD, etc. So my program takes returning combat vets and gets them turned around. From a fiscal perspective, typically the counties are on the hook for treatment and things like that for offenders that come in. In our case, the VA is there, a justice outreach provider. We get these people some outstanding programs that lead them to turning everything around, and they've become miracles. I'm very proud of the work they've done, and I can't say enough in support of this bill. Some of my colleagues have been treating veterans a little bit differently, and I think if we all got on and shared the same values, this bill probably wouldn't be necessary. So thank you for your opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Brown. I'm the Chief Deputy Hennepin County Attorney. As Mr. Hunter mentioned, this is an issue we've been involved in Hennepin County with Mike Freeman, myself, Pete Orpett, when he was an assistant county attorney, for many years. This is the right approach. We are very supportive of this bill. It's an approach we have adopted in Hennepin that allows for stays of adjudication for offenders now. In the past, we did not do that and realized we were behind. Even though we had the first Veterans Court, we were not doing that. We do now. And it is the right approach, and we hope you will support this bill. Thank you very much.
I got a question for you, Mr. Orpett or Mr. Brown.
historically, prosecutors that I know wouldn't use the phrase stay of adjudication without turning sideways and spitting on the ground afterwards. I noticed also that you had said that, you know, part of the problem is we've got a varying degree of which prosecutors are willing to use it. Is this supposed to get all of them on board? I mean, you all got your own election certificates.
I could answer that, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Mr.
Yes, Rossi. It is. There are a number of different variations like Mr. Hunter talked about. All of them are doing something different. I thought if we all take the same focus toward the same values, and I emphasize my view of this is we broke them, we need to fix them. And we did break them. Not all veterans, by the way. Please don't misunderstand me. There are many, many veterans who come back from combat and are okay. But what about the ones who aren't? And this would address it. I'd also want to say a plug for the Veterans Defense Project, of whom I'm on the board. If it weren't for Brock Hunter, I wouldn't have my veterans program. I wouldn't have my 42 graduates who've gone on to wonderful careers and families that they wouldn't have if they were branded with a felony. So I think it's the right thing to do.
Well, let me ask it this way. Does the language, without going through, and if there's a section in here, let me know, where does it allow for the judge to sentence a stay of adjudication over the objection of the prosecutor? Or does it?
That is, Mr. Chair, that is the heart of the bill. I believe if you go through it carefully, it does allow the judge to sentence that over the objection. And what you would have seen in the amendment, I realize that did not come. The County Attorneys Association supports the bill. They have made some of the same kinds of language questions, and so what you're hearing when you say here the county attorneys are doing, we're trying to fine-tune the language, and I commend Mr. Hunter, Ryan Else, the Defense Project, for being willing to work with us on that. But one of the things that allows, yes, the judge can do it, but it now allows some opportunity for both the prosecutor and the victim to weigh in if the judge is going to do that and the victim objects, because I think we have to be concerned with victim input on this as well. And so I think the amendment that they were going to provide provides for that process and a standard by which the judge can make this decision, but it is absolutely the right approach.
Okay, thank you. Just for clarification, can I have research say, is that allowing a judge to sentence stay of adjudication over the objection of the prosecutor, is that in the amendment or is that in the bill, and if so, where?
Mr. Chair, I have not seen the amendment, but in paragraph C, which begins at 2.10 and runs through 2.16, it essentially directs that if the court determines that this veteran is eligible, the court, quote, shall enter the stay of adjudication. The shall language is at 2.12.
You got a couple people on this committee who hate stays of adjudication. You didn't speak to that at all, did you, Representative Grossel? Just curious. Okay.
None in this case.
Okay. All right.
If I might, Mr. Chair, I share the same thing, although in drug cases, I get about 400 young people a year coming into my county, and I choose not to brand them with a felony because they possess small amounts of drugs. And this is same consistency with my values on this, too. Otherwise, I typically eschew stays of a Jude.
I just want to point that out, Chair. That's when it comes to crimsex or child pornography, then yeah. I have issue with stays of adjudication.
You know, members, I think this is a teachable moment. This is instructive. Because 20 years from now, this committee will sit around talking about something else that is kind of the favored subject matter du jour, and we'll wonder why we ever did this. You know, I think the respect that we afford veterans right now is appropriate. But I was in grade school. Actually, I was born when our service members were returning from Vietnam, and the attitude was very, very different. And there's no way this bill would have passed through this legislature back then, because they were pretty darn sure they were all bad. And I think that's unfortunate. But I think we need to be aware of what's going to happen 20 years from now, to what the attitude's going to be. What the attitude's going to be on sex offenses 20 years from now or something, too. I just want us to be aware of that. I think this is the right thing to do. But, Mr. Orpa, did you want to speak to that?
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just add to what you're saying. The first two people I had in my veterans protocol in 2011 were Vietnam veterans. They waited 45 years for somebody to get them into a program.
Thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had some technical questions. I just wanted to say to County Attorney Orpett, you are well known among prosecutors as being a real leader in this area, so
thank you.
Appreciate your leadership on this. So my questions have to do with lines 4.6 through 4.27. I guess I want to focus on the 4.22 to 4.27 first. And I was a little confused about the reference there to Subdivision 1, Paragraph B. If someone could just explain to me what that 4.22 to 4.27 is intended to do, that would be helpful.
This paragraph.
And I don't know if the amendment's going to cover any of this stuff, and if it does, feel free to, we can table this for later, too, if that's.
Yeah.
May I have 1 second, Mr. Orpett?
Yep.
And I think what we'll do after this, members, is we will lay this over so that we have that. We can deal with it when we have the amendment, move on to try to see if we can do earned sick and safe leave before we recess. Mr. Hunter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Moeller. What this basically says is that in those cases where the charge is a presumptive, so the stay of adjudication applies to those cases that are not a presumptive commit to prison. This subdivision says that for those cases that are a presumptive commit to prison, it's not a stay of adjudication, but the court can use service-connected mental health issues as a basis to depart from the presumptive prison sentence and put the veteran on probation.
Representative Moeller.
Yeah, and so I guess my I have two just questions about that. Then the reference to paragraph B doesn't make sense to me. So if someone can just, you don't need to answer that now. Just look at that and make sure it's referring to the right part. But also it says to justify a dispositional or durational departure, and durational departures are typically only granted for offense-related factors, not person-related factors. And this, to me, seems like your intent is more for the dispositional departure rather than the length of time. So that I don't know if that's something the county attorneys are laughing at me in the back. I'm right. I'm right about this, right? I mean, come on.
I speak in Latin.
So, yeah. So that was.
We appreciate you pointing that out, Representative.
All right.
That is definitely our intent, no doubt.
Okay, great.
Zing.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So then if we can get that amendment order, because I don't think we've even received that amendment via email, Representative Eklund, so you can get that, have someone email it to us.
I'll get that taken care of, Mr. Chair.
Okay. That said, then we'll hold the rest of the discussion off until later. And, Chair Johnson?
Chair Lesh, I just wanted to make a statement and thank Marco Milzovic. I just want to thank you for your service. You reminded me of my father, who unfortunately passed away in October. But my dad was in the 82nd. He made hundreds of jumps out of airplanes. 20 years after he retired from the military was the first time he ever landed. I could never figure out why anybody would jump out of a perfectly good airplane, but I do understand, and I want to thank you.
I was 18, and I didn't know any better.
Well, Mr. Milosevic, I've been on one of those airplanes, and after you sit there on the tarmac for 3 hours having to hold your pee, I know why you jump out. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to say thank you so much for your service to our country. I very much appreciate it, and Representative Eklund, thank you for bringing this bill before us. I think that we're I just want to say I think that that this is a very strong step in the right direction.
Thank you, Mr. Milosevic.
I just wanted to add real quick, thank you, Chair, that what this bill really allows veterans to do, whether it be with their lives, their relationships, any of that stuff. My incident between my wife and I, it was used for us as a catalyst to propel us in the right direction, to propel me in the right direction, to start being a better husband and a better father. And as a result, you know, with some of the stuff it's talking about in lieu of sentencing, I went to years of therapy, and I'm still currently in therapy. And so is my wife, and we've done stuff together, and we've done stuff with our children. And I know you brought some of those concerns up before. And I just want you to know that it plugs the veteran back into the veteran community. It makes the veteran start feeling like a veteran again, and it makes you start feeling like a father and a husband, and it does help normalize you. And that, what you said earlier to Representative, is a problem. For we send people to the military, and we break them down, and we build them back up the way we want them. But there is nothing like that for when a veteran gets out of the military. And unfortunately for me, it took contact with the criminal justice system for me to start making those positive changes in my life. And that's what this legislation is going to allow veterans to be able to do. So I really appreciate everybody's support. And, you know, I'm here if you guys have any questions afterwards. So thank you.
Thank you, members. Chair lays over House File 998. Okay, members, we're going to try to get through what we can. But we're supposed to be over at 11:15. We're not going to be over at 11:15, but we're going to try to get through earned sick and safe leave if we can, depending on how it goes, and then come back on it if we have to, but we have to come back on this one anyway. And then, I don't know, I'm going to try to think we'll try to do a half hour on this.
Chair Lesh.
Okay. Chair Johnson.
Just a reminder, a lot of us with the committee situation that we have, a lot of us have meetings scheduled between 11:45 and our next committee meeting at...
I know. I have stuff scheduled for tonight. We have floor session tonight. We are going to do what we can.
Then for me, I have constituents sitting up and waiting in my office for me right now. All okay.
No, I understand. We're coming up on deadlines. That's going to continue to happen. We are going to do what we have to do. And I will tell you what, if session does not go on a long time tonight, depends on how like you guys talk on ERA, then we can come back and get it done. But we will be back here tomorrow night if we have to get through this, just because of the nature of deadlines. Ripson O'Neill.
Just clarification, Charles. So is public safety also meeting? And I think there's 9 of us that are on both committees.
Is public safety meeting? Who can tell me if it's me?
Yeah,
I don't know.
We have one scheduled.
Yep, we're meeting tonight. I don't tell you. Okay, I'm going to get up there. We're going to do what we can
right now.
All right, the next bill we have up for consideration is House File 11, Earned Safe and Sick Time. Chair Lesh, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I would.
All right, Chair Lesh moves that House File 11 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And I believe, Chair Lesh, you also have an amendment.
Madam Chair, I'm just doing a little
Madam Chair, I'll move the amendment.
All right. Are you with us?
Yeah, it works now. No charge, Madam Chair.
All right, Charles, would you like to move your amendment? I believe it's the A5 amendment.
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
Would you like to explain your amendment?
Can I have Mr. Elliott explain the amendment, Madam Chair?
Sure. Go ahead. Welcome, Mr. Elliott. Please introduce yourself.
Brian Elliott with the Service Employees International Union, Minnesota State Council. Very quickly, the amendment is from requests by the Department of Labor and Industry to clarify a few pieces of the bill. Walking through it very quickly, lines 1-2 through 1-5 clarify language about the 90-day period that a worker needs to wait before they are able to start using their accrued sick and safe time. Lines 1-6 and 1-7 ensure that employers cannot retaliate if an employee requests to know how many hours they have accrued. Line 1.8 simply matches the text of that subdivision to the title, which includes comparable position, and so that's what line 1.8 does. Line 1.9 through 1.18 updates the notice requirements to eliminate the 60-day window and match newer language that Dolly is requesting to address when a worker doesn't have a specific work site. Lines 1.19 through 1.21 are already in the bill, but were included in this amendment just for simplicity of the change. And then lines 1.22 through 2.2 prohibit employers from discriminating against an employee based on any information they learn from the medical or safe time documentation that they may receive from that employee.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Arlett. So, Chair Lesh, this amendment puts the bill in the order that you wish.
Yes, it does.
All right. Any discussion of the motion? Those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Aye. Chair Lesh, please go ahead and tell us about your bill, and if you want to tell us what provisions are specific to our committee, too, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, the provisions we're going to be talking about are civil penalties for refusal to submit required records in Section 1, double damages, civil penalties, and attorney's fees in Section 3, and a private right of action in Section 4, Subdivision 3.
Of Article.
Of what?
Of Article
2. Of Article 2. Great. Thank you. So, Madam Chair and members, the bill is before us today primarily for the civil provisions in Article 2. Ultimately, however, we're here because we want Minnesota to be a caring state where our families are healthy and safe. But for too many Minnesotans, that isn't the case right now. And an estimated 36% of working people, or 932,000 Minnesotans, currently do not have access to paid sick and safe time. That means that in a state with the second most Fortune 500 companies per capita, mothers and fathers face the terrible choice between caring for themselves or loved ones in need, and the loss of wages or even employment, because it is still legal for workers to be fired for needing to take time off to take care of themselves or a loved one. So this common sense bill benefits employers through improved recruitment and retention, lawyer-employer health costs through better use of preventive care, and lower presenteeism, which is coming to work sick and coughing on all your coworkers, okay, which some of you people were doing the last few weeks around here, and I didn't appreciate. I just heard one. This results in higher productivity and fewer workplace injuries, and another significant role for rulemaking is to help employers who are already offering similar benefits. So Article 2 creates the enforcement mechanisms that Dolly will need to ensure that workers and employees are protected under the bill, and these are similar to the authority the commissioner already has to enforce other wages and hour violations, which that includes the provisions that I just discussed. So we have some testifiers, and I'd ask we make room for them.
All right. Sounds good. Mr. Elliott, are you testifying again or anyone else?
Come on now.
Are these the opponents or do you have the proponents? Chair Lesh.
I don't know. How about proponents? Commissioner? For you? Yeah, come on up.
Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
So I'm Nancy Lepink, and I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. It's a pleasure to be here today before the committee. The Department of Labor and Industry has had the opportunity to work with Representative Leish regarding the sick and safe leave bill. I think the department is fully prepared to play the role that it's being asked to play related to the administration and enforcement of this bill. It is speaking as a mother, speaking as a daughter, speaking as a wife, speaking as a human being, the ability to take leave when you're sick, to take leave when your child is sick or your spouse is sick, of course, is a critical sort of social contract we should be making with our hardworking families. And so consequently, the department is committed to continuing to work with Representative Leish and, of course, this administration, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan and Governor Walz, of course, also sees the value of this legislation in ensuring the health of our communities, ensuring the prosperity of our communities. So Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do you have other proponents, Chair Lesh?
I don't think so.
All right.
I don't think so, Madam Chair.
Should we go ahead and move to the opponents right now? Then we'll do questions. All right. Let's see. Ms. Schlathors, if you want to come down. I'm sorry, I probably just butchered your name. And
maybe we could see a show of hands of who's here to testify.
Yeah. Is there anybody else who would like to testify either for or against this bill? So we have two more. If you want to just come down. Three. Are there three? Somehow I'm not seeing someone. Why don't you just come on down to the front row? And welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin. And
if we could just remind folks to testify on the provisions that are under the jurisdiction of the committee, Madam Chair.
That is an excellent point, Chair Lesh. So please focus on those provisions relevant to our committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schlathors and I serve as the Labor Management Policy Director for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I appreciate the opportunity to once again provide testimony before this committee, and today I share the views of our members on House File 11. As the committee is aware, but for the purposes of the record, the Minnesota Chamber represents 2,300 employers and over 500,000 employees in every industry across the state. The majority of our members are small and mid-sized businesses, and our membership does include many of Minnesota's Fortune 500 headquartered companies. In my previous testimony on this proposal, I have communicated that we share the goal of giving Minnesotans the access they need to time to take care of themselves and their loved ones. But we continue throughout this process to highlight while balancing employer and employee needs, program scope and costs are also really important in achieving this goal. Throughout this process, we have shared how companies across the state are providing paid leave already, and they are doing so without mandates. This approach enables our companies to develop and provide innovative and specifically tailored benefits to attract and retain employees in a competitive marketplace while ensuring their particular businesses can perform, stay viable, or even grow. A state-dictated mandate benefit, as proposed today, takes away this flexibility and comes with paperwork and reporting compliance mechanisms that add on additional costs, legal exposure, and challenges to our members' operations. We are here today because we are concerned that the bill imposes new fees, liabilities, and unworkable one-size-fits-all leave mandates on our businesses. House File 11 mandates that employers offer fully paid time off in a specific format for an expanded set of familial persons for an expanded list of qualifying events. The bill requires employers to maintain specific records in a specific format or risk significant fines and expanded liabilities. We have heard from our members in cities that have this local ordinance. There are, in fact, struggles with costs and regulatory burdens as well as staffing obligations. I want to reiterate to the committee that employers consider their workforce one of their most valuable parts of their businesses, and this is why they provide benefits and flexibility to retain these trained and skilled employees. However, it is becoming increasingly difficult to keep our Minnesota companies strong because public policies make the cost of doing our business higher than in many other states, from taxes to electricity to health insurance worker comp premiums to share a few. We appreciate the goals of the proposal, but we are concerned another mandate disrupting existing employee benefit packages tailored to the needs of our individual workplaces and industries and employees, and then the challenges that this presents in terms of stacking our workplaces in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to share our perspective on this bill with the committee today.
Thanks for your testimony. Mr. Hansen, we had you down as another. All right, step on up, please. Welcome. You can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Adam Hansen. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. Our contractors, men and women that they employ, are part of the 70% of the construction industry that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. We share a lot of the sentiments that have been shared and that will be shared by other testifiers, but I want to share specifically on how this bill directly affects and disproportionately affects the construction industry. Under the bill, contractors are allowed to exempt themselves of the sick and safe mandate if they provide and pay their workers prevailing wage rates as set by the Department of Labor and Industry, even if the projects aren't funded in whole or in part by state funds. This means that private construction like single-family homes, multifamily living, retail, schools, and city and county construction projects would be subject to prevailing wage mandates under this bill. Exempting contractors from providing the sick and safe time benefit under this bill wouldn't provide those construction workers with that benefit just by paying them a prevailing wage rate. And because prevailing wage rates vary county by county, this would create an 87-county compliance fiasco for our contractors throughout the state, depending upon where they choose to do their construction work. There are numerous examples of where prevailing wage rates vary county by county, even if they are neighboring counties, that would create a headache for payroll and accounting folks at these companies. And with those county-by-county differences comes the increased chance of honest payroll and accounting mistakes, which is what this committee is going to be looking at, those mistakes, those violations, and those civil penalties. And the bill as written does not differentiate between honest mistakes and intentional violations of the law, so we have concerns about that as well. In summation, our members have concerns about this bill and its attempt at implementing a one-size-fits-all wage and benefit package that doesn't take into account what contractors around the state are already doing, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and wait till we get the other testifiers. Well, hopefully he'll stick around and we'll bring him right back up again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, and I think we had two others maybe who weren't on our list. So if you could just keep your comments very brief, please, that would be appreciated. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Newsted with the Minnesota Retailers Association. Three quick comments pertaining to, I think, the purview of this committee. First, I'd like to echo what was just previously said about honest mistakes versus intentional mistakes, and we do think there's an opportunity in the bill to work on that language to recognize a mistake that was honestly made versus one that's intentionally, and we think that's an important distinction. Secondarily, on the private right of action in the bill, I had the pleasure of working on the Minneapolis work group. I was an alternate, though, so I wasn't a true voting member, Mr. Elliott, like Mr. Elliott was, but had the pleasure of being a part of that conversation. I believe in the end, the Minneapolis version of this did not include the private right of action, at least expressly so. So I think that's important to consider in this as well. My industry would much prefer to work with a well-organized process at the state level relative to compliance and compliance and enforcement. And then third, maybe a slight bit outside the purview of the committee, but I'll put it in the category of education and compliance. I noticed the bill does have a provision for grants that are oriented toward educating employees about their rights. I think it'd be helpful to look at how we might look at some grant work to help educate employers about their options and how the bill will work for them as well. So, Madam Chair, those are my comments today. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you keeping those brief, too. All right. And finally, come on up. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Logsland. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Hospitality Minnesota, the umbrella organization representing restaurants, lodging, hotel, resort, and campground industries in Minnesota. The hospitality industry currently provides over 250,000 jobs in Minnesota and $5.4 billion in wages annually in communities across the state. While we do appreciate the spirit of what the author is attempting to do with this bill, we do have some concerns. Hospitality employees, many of which are small businesses in communities throughout your jurisdiction, are able to already provide paid leave benefits. However, many small businesses, like restaurants, operate on very, very thin margins currently. Even though they may be small, they represent jobs, and we want to help them grow more jobs and be successful in Minnesota. It's widely reported that over half of restaurants do not survive their first year, and 80% do not survive the first 5 years. This is a tough, competitive industry. Although many small businesses want to do the right thing, all of our members, the financial burden is significant, and many simply cannot afford to offer more paid benefits at this time. For these reasons, Hospitality Minnesota favors an opt-in approach to address paid leave and work collaboratively with small businesses in the state. One way the legislature could approach this would be to create additional tax incentives to small businesses for offering certain paid leave benefits or participating in a state paid leave program. I would note that other jurisdictions that have passed paid leave legislation have acknowledged the challenges facing small businesses and crafted their laws to address those challenges, including, in some cases, exempting small businesses from the paid leave portion of sick leave. I'll leave my comments there, but I appreciate the committee hearing these comments, and thank you for your consideration.
Okay, thank you very much. Chair Johnson.
I believe it was Mr. Hansen brought up the issue with the possibility of inadvertently wage theft by not having it done correctly. The other day we heard a bill on wage theft, and it didn't matter if it was intentional or unintentional. And in that bill, the contractor would be banned from having any state contracts. Now, you talked about the differences from county to county in prevailing wage. If my question is, if this was brought into law and it inadvertently did something wrong, got charged with inadvertently wage theft, which with the other bill, if it was one of our four or five contractors that can only, the only contractors we have that could do the our roads and bridges, would that entire contractor possibly be banned from doing any work in the state of Minnesota so we can't get our road and bridges done?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, potentially. So a violation of this sick and safe time rule, if it was classified as an underpayment of wage or underpayment of benefits, and, for example, there's a list of criteria under the responsible contractor law that could ding a contractor, and one of those is if a court having jurisdiction finds that you've underpaid any wages, there's no dollar amount set for that. So if you underpay $1 in wage or benefits or $100 or $1,000, if a court finds that you did that underpayment, that would trigger the responsible contractor law, and not only would it prevent the contractor from getting state work, it would be any public contract, so city, county, municipal, or state contract. It could happen to a large contractor, it could happen to a small contractor. It's a big responsibility, and it's a big fear, and everybody wants to comply with the laws. Nobody wants to make a mistake, but the unintentional, inadvertent mistake is the one that contractors fear.
Representative Johnson.
That's one concern I have on this bill. It's set up for failure. And I don't know how we could deal with that. And as the testifier said, this doesn't matter if it's a small company of one employee or one with 10,000. It's treated the same. That gives me a lot of concern. I'm also have some concern with this bill because I've been the unfortunate a loser on sick time. I work for a department that had the sick time, and it's the most widely abused program in the state. As far as and I don't call it a benefit, I call it a perk. I worked for it's not a large department. We had two guys, myself and my partner, who worked the opposite shift to me. We did 10-hour shifts. So 4 days every 28 days we worked the same shift together. And three-fourths of the time, my partner would take a sick day. So out of 4 days where I actually had help, I had about half a day. Couldn't do anything about it. That's the way the rules were written on the sick time. As long as you didn't take more than two off at a time, once you got that third day, you had to have a doctor's excuse to come back to work. But what happened is he ended up injuring himself off duty, and he's begging everybody else to loan him sick time because he didn't have the time, because he abused it. I worked for that department for a number of years, and people that worked there from 1 to 10 years ahead of me, within 5 years I had more sick time built up than a lot of them did because they used it right away. They'd get one day of sick time and they'd use it up. And when they needed it, it wasn't there. And a lot of companies were dealing with that issue, so they changed it. They didn't have sick time anymore. They had personal time off. And so the person was accountable for it. Now, some companies have gone back to sick time now, as one of the testifiers said, but they use it as an issue to hire good employees and to keep good employees. State mandated is not the way to do it. It's set up for problems. It's set up to have this state fail in our transportation system, because there's only a few companies in the state and the surrounding states can actually do the work. It's set up so we can.
Representative Johnson, do you have a question in there? I can tell you feel very passionately about this. But
I'm telling this story now because I have people from my district sitting in my office waiting for me. This committee was supposed to be done 25 minutes ago. We have a committee tonight. There's no reason we couldn't wait till tonight to deal with this bill.
Okay. Chair Lesh, I just had a question for you if you wanted to address, maybe you or your testifier address the wage theft issue that was brought up and the intent, and if these two, if you feel like this has an interplay with that statute at all.
Well, maybe I can have Mr. Elliott speak to that if I could, Madam Chair.
Great. Go ahead, Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Brian Elliott, SEIU. The bill actually simply adds the new section of law as a reference into the existing enforcement authority of DALI with regard to the Fair Labor Standards Act, prevailing wage, and other wage and hour laws. So the treatment is not distinct or different from those.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to just present real concisely here some of the contrarian points that were raised by the business groups here. First of all, you know, the cost that's being added here is very limited. We're talking 0.75% of their total labor costs. This is not a major expense for businesses. With regards to the opposition to this in terms of it being workable, well, we have testimony that said that this is being provided by businesses all across the state. Very similar program. What makes this unworkable versus what they're already providing? So I take that with a grain of salt. And then, most importantly, many of you were involved in this conversation, business community in particular, when the cities took on paid sick time. And the number one complaint that came up over and over again, this is going to create a patchwork that's just going to be unworkable. Well, this is solving that problem. This is providing a statewide program that's going to eliminate the patchwork approach. This was the number one complaint that was brought up over and over again. We haven't heard about that here now. What are we hearing about? Oh, one size fits all approach. I mean, you can't have your cake and eat it too. We are sincerely trying to address the business community's concerns here, and they keep coming up with more and more excuses to oppose this. So either, I would say, in earnest, work with us in making this available to all Minnesotans, or support it and embrace it for what it is and how this is going to be a real benefit for Minnesota workers.
Thank you. I'm hearing there might be another testifier. Is that correct? If I hear that incorrectly. Is anybody else who wanted to testify on that bill? Any other comments from committee members, questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
If people want to get out of here, if we could lay this over on the bill of the discussion until tonight.
Hold on a second. Yep, Representative Cantrell, did you have a question?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Lesh. Really just more of a comment. I think that this is an absolutely fantastic bill, and to Representative Carlson's point, I think that it helps to alleviate those concerns around potentially creating a patchwork of benefits for employees, for workers in the state of Minnesota. And I think when we're looking at securing the quality of life of workers and the quality of life of Minnesotans, this is something that I think we can all get behind as an essential measure to help to create a healthy, vibrant workforce and a vibrant economy as well. So with that, Madam Chair, I just wanted to say thank you, Chair Lesh, for bringing this bill to our committee.
Thank you. Any closing comments, Chair Lesh?
Madam Chair, it's a great bill. It's an excellent bill, and I think it will bring greater equity for folks who not have to decide whether or not they're going to go to work sick and cough on your sub sandwich, or whether they're going to take care of their kids.
Timing is perfect.
Couldn't plan that better.
I knew that timing. That's it. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
All right. At this time, I move that House File 11, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The motion prevails.
Okay. Thank
House
you.
File 11, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
So, Madam Chair, if we could have the CA speak to what we're doing tonight. I think the plan is this, and Ms. Ganani can correct me. Depending on how things go.
Just a second, please. Go ahead.
We have this room at what time?
Starting at 5, and how this meeting has been posted is that this will reconvene at 5 if we don't get through the agenda, or 15 minutes after floor session ends, whichever is later.
Okay.
So we can do that, and then we can.
We're going to take up that 998 and then the other two, which
as
are
when I get the amendment, I'll post it.
Oh, right.
As soon as I get it.
Okay.
And then.
All right. Thank you.
So we're in recess.
Yes,
committee's in recess. All right, we'll call the committee to order.
All right.
And it looks like we have House File 1404, Chair Lesh's bill establishing a legislative commission on intelligence and technology. Chair Lesh, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair. I'd also like to move the, well, actually, Chair Johnson's amendment.
All right, let's start with moving the bill first. So Chair Lesh moves that House File 1404 be recommended to be re-referred to the Government Operations Committee. And then Chair Lesh should like to move Johnson's amendment, the A1, or Representative Johnson, you are here.
Move it.
I am. Would you like to move your own amendment?
Yes, I'd like to move the A1 amendment, which makes this committee a totally bipartisan committee between the House and Senate, equal numbers. It's an important committee, I think, and it needs to be done in a bipartisan way.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Any discussion of the A1 amendment? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Chair Lesh, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill is a product of 17 years of watching different technologies come down the pike, and then the legislature, we are the body that has absolute oversight over all local governments, and local government officials that carry out their functions or duties in the state of Minnesota, finding out after the fact, sometimes years after the fact, that a certain type of technology has been used, and having to find a way to put the genie back in the bottle or provide some guidelines or parameters for how it's used. There has not been the greatest demonstration of responsibility or recognition of the ramifications of those technologies by these local governments due to the fact that it should have been known that, for one example, is that all the data collected by these technologies is public data, unless this committee sets a data set and classification on that data. And that was kind of skipped over as a consideration. I think it's apparent that a little bit more oversight, adult supervision, if you'll forgive the pejorative term, is needed in terms of how this technology rolls out. Now, the juxtaposition that we have is that in reality there is no mechanism in law, nor are we proposing one, to come to the legislature to get legislative approval, although that has been proposed by several members of this committee, that you cannot roll out new technology without approval because, you know, once you've made a mistake, you don't have unfettered use of it, you got to come to us and ask permission again. I'm not proposing that, even though it has been proposed by members of this committee. What I'm proposing is a commission to review these technologies and the way this data is used. And one of the major problems we have had as a legislature is that no one has come forward. It has been a universal attitude of it's much better to beg forgiveness than to ask permission. And we found ourselves in some we've used a lot of committee time on people coming in to beg forgiveness and say, well, really, you can't regulate this anyway. And I'm getting a little tired of that. And I think anyone who's been around here any considerable amount of time would be getting tired of it, too. So this commission would have oversight, knowing full well that members of this commission, it would be non-public, and so there would be no excuse to keep the technology secret, because one of the major problems is we can't let the bad guys know what we're doing. And if we run it through a public legislative committee, the bad guys will know what we're doing, and it will render our technology immediately obsolete, which in most cases is not true, but in some cases is true. And so hence the way that we structured the commission. So that's the reason for it. It is modeled a little bit after the federal select committees on intelligence in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. And for obvious reasons, those committees came into being in the 1970s from the fallout and blowback of the Pentagon Papers members. There was a lot of egg on the face of Congress in the 1970s with the revelation of the Pentagon Papers. And they said, we need some direct oversight. They knew the military folks were not going to come to them for the same reasons that law enforcement was not coming in our instance. And so they said, well, we'll have a secret committee whereby you'll be able to disclose this information to members of Congress who are duly exercising their legislative oversight duties under the Constitution, and we can try to achieve that balance. So I think it's a very fair model, but it honestly has not been heavily vetted. So I'm interested to having it vetted before this committee and see where we can go with it. Did we move the amendment? We did move the amendment. Okay, good. Okay. So I stand for questions.
So do we want to do questions for sitting? There's one person maybe with concerns that wanted to testify, or two. Why don't we get your testimony first, and then we'll do questions. So come on down. All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Hawkins, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Public Safety, and we certainly appreciate the opportunity to share a few comments tonight before you, Madam Chair, and the committee. First, I want to thank Chair Lesh for the conversations he's had with the department over the years. We have touched base briefly this year and look forward to those continuing conversations. The bill as drafted would not only affect state agencies, but all government entities, including local governments and schools. I understand from the department's conversations with Chair Lesh and some of the language in the bill, this commission is intended to be used to review emerging technology. However, the language as drafted provides no limits to that effect. We look forward to those continuing conversations with Chair Lesh, and we understand he's open to working on the language. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Great. Thank you. Next, come on down. All right. Well, welcome. Please introduce yourself. You can begin.
Good evening, members, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, Eric Hyland representing the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. You'll see on the agenda that Tim Leslie was previously signed up to testify, but he wasn't able to be here. I'm going to be really, really brief. I think there's just a reminder that local governments approve purchases and approve policies. And there is public input at those levels. And I appreciate Representative Lesh's and many, many other legislators' frustrations in the past. But I think it's important to realize that these decisions are not being made by law enforcement in particular in a vacuum. They are accountable to their elected bodies and continue to be able to work with Representative Lesh on this issue.
All right. Thank you. Were there any other testifiers? All right. Chair Lesh, did you want to comment on either of those two testifiers before we move to questions?
Well, I would note, Madam Chair, my memory would be faulty, but the only memory I have of anyone raising, because I think we did do a hearing on this in past years. I just can't remember what year. And the only objection I heard came from Mr. Neumeister. And Mr. Neumeister's objection was, well, we can't do this because it wouldn't be fully open and public. And I said, well, yeah, that's, you know, kind of the idea. Law enforcement's not going to tell you anything if it's a public setting. And now what you've heard just now is concerns regarding that we would be reviewing it. I would ask members to keep in mind that there is no constitutional provision for local government in the United States of America. The United States Constitution provides for two levels of government, a federal government and a state government. Every local government, whether it's a county, a school district, a city, a mosquito-controlled district, they are all creatures of state government and creatures of state law. The only qualification to that is in the University of Minnesota, which exists in the Minnesota Constitution, which is not technically a local government, it's a land grant. So the bottom line is the statement that ultimately it's local government that is responsible for making these decisions and carrying them out and is accountable for them, that's not technically accurate. You're accountable for all of them. because you are the overseeing authority for everything in the state of Minnesota, unless it's federal. You don't oversee Fort Snelling. You do oversee Camp Ripley because it's a state institution. However, it's run mostly by federal dollars. So there are some qualifications there. But in a sense, you're responsible for all this. So everything that happens with law enforcement in the state is under your charge. And right now, there has been no accountability for it. It's been the Wild West. And because of emerging technologies, we've seen the drip trickle out of having to deal with it repeatedly. And I will use one example with the most recent, one of the most recent issues we saw with the body cams. The city of Minneapolis rolled out their body cams. The horse was going to get out of the barn on that. It's an emerging technology. It wasn't going to go away. Most people agreed, I think, that they should be out. There was just disputes about how it should be used and the procedures for how it should be used. The year immediately preceding the rollout of the body cams, I asked the city of Minneapolis if they could please just have a policy in place before rolling out this new technology. So it wasn't the total Wild West, and there was some accountability to the own policy. I was assured that there was a policy in place that was going to be followed with the pilot program. The next year, with the hearing in this committee, the policy I was presented with was a one-page SOP. Now, if any of you know any of the difference between an SOP and a policy, it's pretty substantial. Okay, it's not, you are not accountable for anything with a standard operating procedure. That demonstrated to me that there is just not the sophistication and ability, even by the state's largest police department, to really handle these newly emerging technologies. It does require some level of oversight as this rolls out. Otherwise, you know, these night hearings, you're going to see them in future years on facial recognition technology, on whatever's after, what's next. And I think it can be mitigated by delegating it to the members of this commission who are accountable for it and then are accountable to you, but also have to keep their mouths shut so they're not allowed to disclose this. Anyway, that's the framework. That's my response framework for it.
Okay. We can do questions now. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I want to thank you for this. I don't have any questions. I'm also a co-author on this bill. To explain a little bit on my side of it, on the law enforcement side of it. I've talked to a lot of guys on the street. This is my seventh year down here, and every year we deal with the issues dealing with the technology law enforcement has in the back blow, mostly from the data. And this committee deals with the data. They get the technology is purchased with the permission of their local jurisdictions, whether it's the city council or the county commissioners, and sometimes even the state if the BCA is getting this equipment. The problem is we sometimes don't hear about it until we hear the back blow about the data and the special request to keep the data private. And it's special rules of keeping that data from the public. The reason I'm in favor of this, it gives us an opportunity before that technology goes out to make sure that data is protected if it needs to be, or it's going to be public, how long the data is kept. Being in law enforcement is always two steps behind in technology that the bad guys are using. The detection of it with the technology that they have is expensive for us to purchase, and when they find out what we have, they don't go one or two steps above what law enforcement has to combat the technology they have. The longer we can delay the finding out about the technology law enforcement has, the better chance we have of catching the bad guys. That is the reason I'm in favor of this bill, and I don't like it, but I believe we need to do it.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lesh, when I first read this bill, I actually was kind of excited about it. And I think it's a really good idea. And I'll tell you, it's not even just for what this is about, but for quite some time, I've thought that we need a process in the Minnesota House for reviewing some things that are kept private. Because we as legislators are really at a disadvantage in a number of areas because we're not allowed to see stuff that's private. You know, and I run into this in the Health and Human Services area all the time. I mean, you know what we're talking about. Everything from, you know, what HMOs are paying to, you know, certain things. Oh, that's our business practices. You're not allowed to know. And it's stuff that maybe the agencies do know. They're allowed to know. But we, the elected officials who are accountable to the public, are not allowed to know. Mm-hmm. And so this, of course, is limited in its scope. But I think it's a good thing to try. See how it works. I had a discussion with Mr. Nobles, our legislative auditor, about this very topic like some years ago. I think it might have been around the stadium discussion because there was data that he was able to review that we were not. Mm-hmm. And it just really frustrated the heck out of me, but there was nothing in law that allowed us to get that private information without then having it become public. So I really like this. The one concern I have, and it certainly wouldn't stop me from voting for the bill, is just about sort of the expansion of legislative expectations and responsibilities, because this is taking 8 legislators and putting them on this commission, and we do a lot of stuff around here where it's we'll put members on this and we'll put members on that, and I don't know if the speaker and the minority leader can even fill those commissions anymore. And I would just say, and I know members don't like to hear this, the public doesn't like to hear it, I think we need to go to a full year-round legislature, because there is work to do and we are just not able to do it very well in this super compressed time frame that we have right now, and all of these expanding responsibilities of things where legislators are really needed to do this work, and yet I look at things like this, I go, oh my God, how could I ever do that, you know, beyond this and do the service? And yet I know that we really have to do this kind of work. So those are my comments. I just really appreciate you thinking creatively and doing this kind of work. I think it's really needed.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Liebling. I'd be lying if I say I didn't have concerns about going on this road either. I mean, the idea is that there's a principle that we're kind of losing our innocence a little bit by admitting to ourselves that something like this is necessary, right? Just like when the nation went through that after Vietnam with the Pentagon Papers, and then Watergate occurred as well, and it was all about information, what information was hidden. And a nation, at least it was said according to some social commentators, lost its innocence during that period because of that. I'm not sure that's totally true. I think we go through cycles of it up and down. But it is kind of the feeling that really, are we really going here? And after being here 17 years, members, I do think it's necessary. And it was that I read up a lot about that years ago when I first thought that something like this might be necessary, and saw a lot of the same concerns echoed on a national level in the 70s when they created the House and Senate Select Committees on Intelligence. So thank you for your comments.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Lesh, for this bill, or Chair Lesh, for this bill. I'm conflicted because I like sunshine, and I think that the contracts that law enforcement has with any provider of any company that's giving them ongoing, you know, help with their data and those sorts of things, that's already public. It can be obtained through a data request. The same with any purchases that they make. Those can all be we can find out about those now. Law enforcement isn't always real forthright in wanting to provide that, and we found that out with some of the providers in the HMOs when really technically any contract that a private company has with the state of Minnesota is also subject to the Data Practices Act. But the HMOs was a specific carve-out, and I believe didn't we on that a few years ago give them a 2-year moratorium on pursuing making those public, and then there was some letter up to the Fed
the federal government. It came back down, and oh, this might be problematic to make those public. So I'm really conflicted because I think, at least with law enforcement, as far as that goes, I think we can get that data. And so I'm wondering if it might be kind of a middle ground to have the Data Practices Commission, since I think you're carrying the bill to renew that, I think, Representative Lesh or Chair Lesh. And I think there's an appropriation for a part-time staff person for that. But to get a staff person hired and that could do focus on this kind of thing, that could inquire of law enforcement what they do have and then have the Data Commission, you know, take that up. But then, again, you're going, I guess what the Data Commission does with that is maybe what we would need to discuss, because I know law enforcement is not going to want that out there for everyone and their mother to see, but it is public information if anybody wants to find out now. So that's why I'm conflicted about this, and I don't know if you have any response to that, but that's kind of where I'm at.
Madam Chair and Chair Scott, so I'm not adverse to that. There is a model for that, and that is the Capitol Security Commission that does go into closed session from time to time to discuss, you know, I don't know, a certain security concern about, you know, an air duct that a terrorist could climb through or something, and let's not have it public or whatever. So there's a precedent for that. Well, when they were discussing the Data Practices Commission, you know, that was kind of former Representative Holberg's baby, and I had kind of been interested in having this be a piggyback on that, but her push in doing that was not really this. It was more about studying data practices as a whole and getting members up to speed on Chapter 13 and how we can really understand it in a very academic but important way. And it didn't feel like it was going to be the right fit at the time. I would have liked to have seen that happen, but there would have been a separate provision in the Data Practices Commission enabling legislation that provided for closed sessions and that kind of thing we wouldn't do. We could do that. I don't know if and the other thing I would point out is that this proposal that I have today is, as you can see, opposed by both law enforcement and open government folks, okay? All right?
You know you're onto something.
So, and the open government folks haven't testified today, but I can tell you, I know Neumeister hates it, okay? Because he thinks everything should be open. And I know that the open government advocates also kind of see the Data Practices Commission as their baby and wouldn't necessarily want to kind of bastardize it with something like this. All that said, I wouldn't be adverse to that type of a solution. I think it's a fair solution. It would be good, but that's why I wanted to have the conversation about it.
Any other questions? Representative Johnson? Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Carlson, you go.
Well, I was going to quote Representative Johnson. You know, it doesn't feel quite right, but it's necessary, I think, was the term he used. And having read through this, I feel the same way. Madam Chair, Chair Lesh. So, using some of the examples you said of what this could be modeled after. For example, to have some transparency to the public, could there be an agenda posted to time and who they would be meeting with, and then with some details in terms of the information that may, you know, to not disclose perhaps sensitive information, but to at least recognize the fact that a meeting was held and who was present?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, I haven't thought that far through it. I will say this. If you look at the Select Committee on Intelligence in the House and Senate in D.C., essentially the meetings are posted. Rarely are they posting who they're meeting with or what the subject matter of the meeting is. They will have some open meetings, the things that they can discuss, you know, in open, you know, in public. But they all have top secret security clearances and are cleared for that annually. My feeling about how this accountability piece would work would be this. If you're one of these eight legislators that sits on this commission, you're sworn to secrecy, You cannot discuss it unless it is expressly authorized, okay? And then what happens is this. If this thing blows up, okay, if something blows up, if there's some big scandal in government, and you didn't say anything about it, it's on you because you had the review authority of what happened here. You did have the opportunity as a member of this commission to raise a concern in open committee outside of what you heard, but request that there be either the OLA look into it or another agency look into it to determine what's happening without disclosing your confidence if you have concerns about that. That's how the accountability is going to work. And then if you didn't raise that question, when you see something coming down the pike that doesn't quite pass the smell test and you fail to do that, then guess what? It's going to be a live at five thing, 2 years down the road, and guess what? You heard it. You were on the commission right then, right? Did you discuss it? Well, yeah, okay. That's how the accountability piece works for me. And that's kind of how it works on the federal level as well.
Well, I think Representative Johnson, you're next.
All right. Chair Mulder, Representative Lesh, I agree with you. It's a tough decision to make. It's and as you said, the open side doesn't like it, and the law enforcement doesn't like it. That makes me think it's probably the right thing to do. When neither side likes it, it's usually pretty good. This is a serious issue that we have to talk about. We have some serious issues coming up. We have with some of the things going on across this world that could actually happen here. So we do need to look at things and make sure that we do things the right way to make sure the citizens of this state are safe, and also that this commission would also be protecting their data.
Madam Chair, I want to be clear, too, that I don't know if I already said this, but the intent of this commission is that it's not a sign-off authority. Okay? It's not going to be as though if you want to deploy another type of technology or use of, like, a tactic or whatever, that you come to the commission and have to get that signed off on. I don't think that's appropriate, nor is it even feasible. Like, there's no way. I mean, that's like, it'd have to be like the PUC. It'd have to be like a full-time job. That's not what is being proposed. It's merely a review authority for, I don't know, things that come up.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I was listening to Representative Carlson and the openness piece, and I understand that city councils or local government was mentioned, but I would just add to the conversation, if it hasn't been mentioned already, as a former city council member, we would have closed session. We would go into, well, and actually, Rep. Carlson is a former council member as well. Yeah. So we would go into closed session, and it would be very generic as to what the topic would be that's going to be discussed, but we'd be behind closed doors. And then afterwards, after whatever, if it's a lawsuit or whatever was being discussed, was resolved, it could be months or years later, but after that was resolved, then the accountability piece came into play because it would come out. All the details and, in fact, the recordings, if there were any, things like that. So
yeah, I was going to say that there still is a tape of what took place, just not made available to the public, but at least there is that testimony. That's a good point. That's a model that this could follow.
And then, Madam Chair, the other piece that I would just add in, if it also hasn't been mentioned, I apologize, I was late, so I'll just be quick on this, that the status quo, as we're considering this as a commission, the status quo, I think, is a threat to open government, because there have been technologies that have been deployed, and this body doesn't find out for years later in some cases. So I think we should also take that into consideration, that if the goal is openness in government and transparency, this isn't necessarily the antithesis of that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the things that was mentioned was that the city councils and the counties and stuff, those local law enforcement entities, they're accountable to the people, and they have, it's transparent and everything on that level. And I know that in our county, the sheriff only has to come before the county commissioners to get permission for a purchase if it's over a certain dollar amount.
I think it's $25,000 or something. Well, you could purchase a pretty nice drone for $15,000. And case in point, and, you know, Sheriff Stanek had a group of legislators out when they got a drone to show, give us a demonstration, and we were out in the field there by the offices, and they were showing us how it was used. And I said, "Well, Sheriff Stanek, did you go to the people of the city, you know, the county commissioners or whatever, to get approval for this, or, you know, what did the people have to say about it?" "Well, no. Why would I do that?" And I've never forgotten that. I was just really taken aback that it just seemed like that was just what they did. They acted as an island unto themselves, and I felt that was not appropriate. So I don't know what the answer is here, and I know that this has been a thought of yours for several years. And but anyway, I just wanted to offer that little information as well.
Thank you. Any further comments, Shirlesh?
Madam Chair, members, this is a work in progress, and I appreciate the conversation. I think it's a good conversation. I think we need more, and we'll see what's shaking over at GovOps or wherever this is going.
So we didn't say the motion quite right. It needs to go back to Ways and Means first. And so I think at this point we need to amend the motion to recommend that it be re-referred to Ways and Means. Would we move to amend?
Move to reconsider the motion. Can you amend it? Can you just amend it?
Yes. Okay. What language do we need?
We are not parliamentarians.
Okay. We're going to do the Lesh way then. Madam Chair, I move to reconsider the motion that it goes to GovOps.
So to Ways. All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
So, Madam Chair, I move that it goes to Ways and Means. It be re-referred to Ways and Means.
Okay.
As amended.
All right. So, all those in favor that the motion as amended be referred to Ways and Means, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Well, we just voted
really
on the bill.
Really hope we did that right.
That's the bill.
What's
so.
That?
You just
moved
to as amended.
Yeah, we just moved the bill to.
Ways and Means. That was going to happen anyway. I mean, that's fine. Right? But, okay, well.
It's been a long night.
It's been a really long night.
Yeah, that's okay. That's all right. All right, well, we'll see what's happening at Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Reconsider. We need to make something clear for the record here.
Madam Chair, we should move the bill as amended to Ways and Means.
Not the motion as amended.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's do that. Let's just make sure that we're clear here. We're moving the bill as amended to the Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Do that again.
Okay.
All right. Next, members, we have House File 1567, and that is Turlesh's bill modifying location tracking to include GPS service or cell site location information service. Turlesh, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
That would be my motion, Madam Chair.
All right, Turlesh moves that House File 1567 be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So we have the bill before us. If you'd like to tell us about your bill, please.
Yes, I've got this fair, Madam Chair. And just while he's coming up, keep in mind, members, that this has been one of those things that's been going down for years. Folks may remember the kerfuffle over putting GPS trackers on folks' interlock devices. For folks who are not familiar with an interlock devices were first enacted. We first put that in, 2011 or something? Interlock?
2007.
Was it 2007? Yeah. Holy cow. Okay, whatever. And that means that once you get a DWI, rather than having to go down and get a work permit or not driving, you can get this interlock device put on your car and go, you know, and then the car starts up, and I don't really know. I haven't had one on my car yet, but I think that's how it works. And then you're driving down the highway, and it says beep, 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 and you got to stop the blowing again, too, sometimes, I think, too, right? So that you're not driving drunk, and it protects the road. Advocates
in recent years had been pushing with the Department of Public Safety to get real-time and tracking on these. That happened to favor a particular company who had it already deployed in the field. There was some nervousness among members of this committee, to say the least, of how did this happen? And it was discovered that the department used its expedited rulemaking authority to do so. I don't know if I said that right, if it was expedited or its rulemaking authority. And go ahead, Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, thanks. It was actually when Ignition Interlock came about, they were exempted from rulemaking, I believe is what it was.
That's right. So we exempted them from that. And because they used that authority to suddenly start tracking folks and do real time, it gave a lot of people heartburn around here, saying that was not that was not our intent. We did not authorize this. It goes beyond the spirit of what we initiated this for. And there was a lawsuit over it, too, I think. I think I remember hearing there was a lawsuit. And so this addresses that. I can't remember what year that was that there was the blow-up over the rulemaking authority, but the legislature then rescinded that year. And you guys were in control, right? That must have been 3 years ago, ballpark?
I think so.
2017, okay, so 2 years ago. The legislature stepped in to specifically rescind the ability to be exempt from rulemaking because we were not happy about it. I'm still not happy about how that went down. I feel like it was not done with integrity. We have a different administration now, et cetera. I get it. Sometimes these are the things we grapple with. So.
All right. And you have a testifier?
I do.
Then welcome, introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name's Ed Cohen. I'm one of the co-owners of Smart Start Minnesota, the only Minnesota-owned ignition interlock company. I've been involved in the ignition interlock industry for many years, and in fact, I was working on this long before I was ever involved with an ignition interlock company, simply as a private lawyer. In fact, there's likely no one in the state of Minnesota who's been involved in the ignition interlock program or the study of ignition interlock longer than me. I'm here to testify in favor of House File 1567 proposed by Chair Lesch. This bill will provide needed security to the private location data of many individuals who enter the ignition interlock program. This bill, as noted by Chair Lesch, is a clarification to legislation passed in 2017, which sought to prevent the creation of location data on participants in the ignition interlock program. The broad language of the 2017 legislation has been interpreted by the Department of Public Safety to allow the continued use of wireless systems which create this location data. This bill expands the definition to specifically include cell site location information, or CSLI, which is created through the use of wireless devices communicating with cell phone towers. While the department will likely indicate that they don't store or otherwise collect this CSLI data, the data is an inevitable byproduct of the use of the wireless devices. This data is collected and aggregated by cell phone providers who, as is indicated in two articles that's provided in your packet related to this bill, cell phone providers have been selling this location data, the CSLI, to private entities for many years. By way of some background, the Minnesota Ignition Interlock Program is somewhat of an aberration in the use of wireless reporting. No other state has ever required that all Ignition Interlock participants be required to have wireless systems in place to report data, many of whom are first-time offenders. However, this bill is not a ban on all wireless reporting. This bill leaves in place the 2017 language, which allows the use of wireless reporting with a court order. If an individual is ordered by a court as part of their DUI sentence or as part of probation, then wireless technology could be used to monitor that individual. And it's important that probation be continued to allow this type of technology. Probation departments have the staff and the mission of actively monitoring these individuals, and probation has the resources to respond to violation notices that occur in real time. For all of the participants in the Ignition Interlock Program, public safety is always being protected through the use of the Ignition Interlock device. The interlock device is a prophylactic device that prevents the vehicle from being started once it detects alcohol. The reporting of the data is entirely secondary to the function of separating drinking from driving. it is the device itself, not the method in which reporting occurs, that prevents a vehicle from starting if a driver has been drinking. I would ask that the committee approve Chair Lesch's House File 1567.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Any other proponents for this? Anybody who wants to testify in favor of it?
Yes,
Senator. Yep, come on down. Hi, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself and you can
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Janelle Shannon. I'm an attorney at Johnson Becker. I'm one of the attorneys that was involved in the litigation that you're referencing regarding the GPS data. I'm testifying in favor of Bill 1567. I'd like to comment on the legal realities surrounding Bill 1567 and specifically problems that will result if Minnesota Statute 171.306, Subdivision 1C, is not clarified to specifically include cell site information. First, and if you take anything away, please take this. The Supreme Court of the United States recently found as fact that cell site information is location information. It found this in Carpenter v. United States, a decision which was issued just last year, and it in 2018. And because cell site CSLI data is location data, and because the government cannot access this data without a warrant, the Supreme Court of the United States found that the federal government violated Timothy Carpenter's Fourth Amendment rights when it requested and received Timothy Carpenter's cell phone records, which included CSLI data from his cell phone company. They received those records without a warrant. The same thing is happening here as we speak. I know this. I've been involved in the litigation. These private manufacturers are collecting CSLI data. They're sending it to the state, and they are violating Minnesotans' ignition airlock participants' Fourth Amendment rights on an ongoing basis. The reason, one of the reasons I believe that they're doing it is that the statute as written has the potential for being ambiguous. It doesn't specifically state that cell site location information, cell site information rather, is location tracking data. Please add this proposed language to the statute to clarify. As an attorney, it's always very much appreciated. If it's not clarified, there will be litigation over the scope, potentially, of location tracking capabilities. And in fact, the fact that this language is proposed, and in the future, if it's denied, could be used by an attorney to support the argument that cell site data was not intended to be incorporated or included in the scope of location tracking capabilities. Now, in addition to legal reasons, there are other practical reasons why this statute must be clarified. First, in addition to cell site CSLI, I'll just say data, private ignition airlock manufacturers collect participants' name, address, phone number, driver's license number, social security number, address, and their photo. Right now, under the current state of the law, as articulated by the Minnesota Court of Appeals last year, all of that information, that exchange between the private manufacturers and the state, is going on wholly outside of the data protections of the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. The Supreme Court found, or the Minnesota Court of Appeals found, that the government was not collecting data. The private manufacturers were collecting, not the government, and thus this data is not within the purview of the MGDPA. What does this mean? Also, that there was no ability for the state and the manufacturers to contract to bring it within the privatization subdivision 11 of 13.05. So what does that mean? These companies can collect and amass huge amounts of data and sell it. We all know that data is incredibly valuable. There is nothing that is preventing them from doing this. I know that companies find, you know, maybe what I've been Googling to be valuable data, I cannot imagine how valuable they would find my actual location and exploiting that and being able to sell that. And additionally, if the state is operating as if this data is under the MGDPA and it's public, then there are the same safety concerns as there were with the GPS data. You don't want perhaps a vulnerable individual to be targeted, have their safety put in jeopardy because their location is potentially public. This can be remedied by not collecting the cell site location information in the first place by clarifying the act. I would like to thank, in closing, the authors of this bill for realizing that clarification of Section 171.306 is needed and for proposing the clarification. I'm open to any questions, and I support this bill.
All right, thanks. Looks like we do have questions, but let's get all the testifiers, if you don't mind, just sticking around. And I think anybody else in favor of the bill to testify? And I think we have some people with concerns, so come on down.
Good evening.
All right, welcome. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Mike Hansen, and I have the privilege of serving as the Director for the Office of Traffic Safety in the Department of Public Safety. At the Office of Traffic Safety, our mandate is traffic safety, obviously, and preventing needless tragedies from occurring on all Minnesota roadways. Ignition Interlock has proven to be one of those very successful and effective programs that have addressed the impaired driving issue that we continue to face across the state. Ignition Interlock works for many circumstances and many folks who find themselves in a position to be on the program, particularly those who are repeat offenders and those who are reported to have a high alcohol concentration. The Department of Public Safety has some concerns with the legislation as written that it will have a detrimental effect on the effectiveness of the Ignition Interlock program as it stands today. Just a few things to keep in mind about Ignition Interlock and the real-time reporting that we are discussing right now. Since 2011, we have had at least one of the vendors who have had the real-time reporting basically through the CSLI. Some of the advantages that come along with the real-time reporting: it allows the immediate sanction or relief in the case of an error for reported violations versus sanctions potentially a month later after the calibration check. So if we don't have that real-time reporting, the violations are not going to be detected until the program participant goes in for the monthly or the bi-monthly calibration check. And so it extends out that time where the sanction cannot take place. Potential violations received by the vendor are relayed to DVS the next day in the case of the real-time reporting. So we have a way to understand and to acknowledge when somebody either has a violation of the Interlock program or if there's tampering or something like that that goes on. DVS Interlock, Ignition Interlock staff uses the data delivered by the vendors to determine if the participant has committed a violation based on a photo match that comes along with that real-time reporting. DVS Ignition Interlock staff reviews the reported violations to determine if, in fact, there actually has been a violation and that it was committed by the participant. Again, the photo match and the real-time reporting are used as confirmatory evidence of that. DVS does not have access to any of the CSLI. We don't have access to it. We have no need to access it. And it allows participants to, by having the real-time reporting requirement, this allows the participants to have the calibration check every 2 months instead of every month. This saves the participants not only the time and the effort to go in and have their unit calibrated and checked, but it also saves them, or could potentially save them, the fee that the vendors do charge for those calibration checks. I'd just like to conclude by reading just a brief section of a report that the Office of Traffic Safety commissioned in 2016 that was an evaluation of the Ignition Interlock program in Minnesota. And this was conducted by an independent outside research firm. And this is in the recommendation sections of the report. And I quote, "Effective monitoring of offenders has shown to increase program participation. Although it can be difficult for administrative Ignition Interlock programs to monitor offenders, vendor monitoring of offenders can aid in the retention of program participants. streamlining vendor reporting to allow consistency between vendors and increase vendor data accuracy is critical in the overall monitoring of the offenders. Minnesota's recent efforts in 2016, I add, to require wireless transmittal of device data will help meet this objective. Having near real-time data will help identify participants with a high failed test rates early and provide time for additional intervention as they are less likely to successfully complete the interlock program. And those findings have also been substantiated by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration in subsequent examinations of successful ignition interlock programs. I appreciate the committee's time tonight. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lesh.
All right, thanks. We have several questions. I just have one, too. Oh, there's another opponent, too. Let me just ask this while you're coming down, and maybe it's not understanding how ignition interlock works exactly. So if there's a violation, the machine itself function so that the car can't start. Is that correct?
Well, if there's a violation, it will be recorded in the ignition interlock device. If the alcohol concentration is above a certain threshold, I believe it's 0.02%, it will not allow the car to start. If it's one of the rolling checks that takes place, it will record that violation, and then I don't believe it will allow the car to restart at that point as well.
And so then wouldn't the person have to do something? Do they have to, who do they contact then if that happens?
Then they would have to go through the vendor, and then they would have to have the calibration checked or have the system reset, is my understanding.
And then would you be getting that information at that point when they go to the vendor?
That would be reported from the vendor to Driver and Vehicle Services, yes.
Okay. All right, thank you. We've got one more testifier here. All right. Welcome back. Please introduce yourself. You can begin.
Yeah. Eric Hyland again.
Yep.
This time representing Intoxilock, and Representative Lesh is giving me grief for hitting the daily double today, apparently. I do represent a company called Intoxilock. They are the nation's largest vendor of ignition interlock devices. They are based in Des Moines, Iowa. Mr. Brad Fralick, Intoxilock's Director of Government Relations, would have liked to be here, but he was not able to make it. And so he has asked me to present just a very brief written statement on Intoxilock's position on this. Intoxilock, the largest of six certified Minnesota ignition interlock vendors, opposes House File 1567. Interlock providers are currently required to send BAC, blood alcohol content data, and associated digital images in real time via cellular service to the Department of Public Safety in accordance with administrative rules. Five of the six Minnesota vendors currently comply with state requirements. This real-time reporting allows the department to monitor offenders and to take action swiftly when there are violations. The cellular connectivity also allows participants who are in a lockout status to call the vendor and have the device unlocked so they may use the device again after taking a required test. If this legislation were to pass, the participants with a lockout from a legitimate violation would be forced to have the vehicle towed to a service center to have the device reset. As with the GPS data that we've talked about previously, that was banned from being recorded by legislation in 2017, location data derived from cellular triangulation is not sent to GPS. There is no need to, as is like the GPS data. The department does not and never has requested such data. The only results of the breath testing and the images associated with it are transferred. The collection of location data via GPS was recently subject to a lawsuit alleging that its collection violated the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. The Fourth District Court ruled that the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act does not apply, and this was affirmed by the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Signed, Brad Fralick. So any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Thank you, members.
All right, so we do have a list of questions here. Representative Lucero, you're up first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess it was to the attorney who was part of the lawsuit.
Yep, Ms. Shannon, come on back down, please.
And the question I would have, if you could just remind the committee, what was the Supreme Court vote of that ruling? Was it 6-3? Was it?
Yeah. Come on, come on back down.
5-4, Madam Chair.
5-4. Okay.
Yeah, from my attorney.
Is that all you needed?
And then, not a question, but a comment.
Okay.
I'm definitely intrigued with some of the remarks that you had and the last testifier that was just up here in regards to this, court ruling about this stuff not falling under data practices. I'd very much be interested in picking your brain and hearing some ideas that you might have for other legislation, because as I'm reading this in lines 1.7, 1.8, existing law is this definition that we're changing. It reads, as used in this section, the terms of this subdivision have the meaning given to them. So this applies obviously only to interlock. And I think that this is an important expansion of the definition for other areas of Minnesota law. So I would encourage you to please reach out to my office, Clay.
Yes, absolutely. We can schedule that after the meeting if you'd like very much.
Madam Chair, first of all, Mr. Cohen would like to be heard in response to a couple of the items that were raised. I did want to point out, after your shrewd line of questioning about the fact that you were accountable immediately afterwards if you had a violation, you know, under the previous system anyway or in the current system for Smart Start. Members, the allegation that the Department of Public Safety does not collect location data, nor does it need the location data, is belied by the fact that just having the data out there means it's available. And mark my words, if this system is allowed to continue, they will have it at some point. They absolutely will. Just look at the FBI and the San Bernardino shooter's phone saying Apple needed to provide a backdoor because it was there. If the data exists, there will be a reason to go get it on everyone at some point. And we have to be aware of that, because eventually the horse is out of the barn and this committee is chasing after that horse, just like we are off the other technologies that we've had come down the pike in the 10 years. But if I can have Mr. Cohen speak to some of the other items.
Go ahead, Mr. Cohen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Just a couple of points that I heard from some of the other testifiers that I'd like to clarify a little bit. The department states that the data comes in immediately, and while there is a grain of truth to that, it is not data that the department acts on. Data that the department gets that they act on comes in a day or two following an incident, and from there, in an extreme case, which is a canceled driver who had a positive alcohol test, they then cancel the driver's privileges 10 days later. But it's important to note that for the most part, most people who have a positive alcohol test, if they are sanctioned at all, are not sanctioned until the end of their time on ignition interlock. And I realize we start getting off in the weeds a little bit about the exact way that the program works, but I want to make it clear that this idea that there's some sort of magic data that comes in that somebody is acting on immediately is not true. It's not accurate. The important thing is that the device stops somebody from driving. As you noted, Madam Chair, you correctly have ascertained the fact that the ignition interlock device is what stops somebody from driving. If I get behind the wheel of my car and I blow over 0.02 into my ignition interlock device, my car won't start. The fact that that gets reported to somebody today, tomorrow, next week, really isn't relevant. The car didn't start, it wasn't moved, and it couldn't be involved in some sort of a driving incident, accident, or death. And I really think that that's something that this committee should focus on. We're not talking about depriving the state of the ability to stop people from drinking and then driving in their interlock-equipped cars. We're talking about the reporting. And the reporting is really secondary to the idea that we're stopping people before they get behind the wheel and drive. One last thing with the testifier on behalf of Intoxilock, and I just want to clear this up. Sometimes people focus on things like this. He indicated that somehow if we don't have a wireless system, that drivers are going to be stuck with a car that has to be towed to a service center. That's simply not accurate. Every manufacturer, every device is required to be unlocked by entering a code into it so that the vehicle can be driven in. So if a person finds themselves where they have, due to their own actions, gotten themselves locked out of their vehicle, we are obligated to provide them with a method of getting that vehicle started so that it can be driven to a service center with the interlock fully working during that time. There is simply not a case where an individual should ever be stuck in a place because of a violation that occurred that cannot be unlocked by a simple act of providing a code to the device. So I just want to make sure that we're real clear on what those facts are, and I believe that was probably a misstatement. That's all I have.
Okay. Let's see. Chair Scott.
Madam Chair, I have one last question. Lucero.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
And that was not a question, but more of a comment. So as I listened to the testifiers, some of the capabilities that were explained were real-time reporting, remote calibration, rolling violations, and things like that. And I'm thinking back to 2017 when we had this conversation. These are mutually exclusive actions from tracking. So the collection of location information is not needed for real-time reporting. A violation reporting can be, notification can be sent. A remote calibration, things like that. And so I just find those statements from these other testifiers, if, as I'm thinking back to 2017, again, they're mutually exclusive. And then to the chair's point about when private companies, we've seen the many stories, when private companies are collecting this information, it may not be going to government, but government knows that the private sector, private companies, has this information, and then we're seeing government come in and request information, and these private companies are voluntarily turning the information over without the need for a warrant. And if this stuff is being collected, the chair is spot on in terms of it being a risk.
Thank you. Chair Scott.
I'm going to pass. Thanks.
All right. Let's see. Representative Robbins.
Oh, no.
Okay.
She was just scratching her nose.
It's a good thing I'm not an auctioneer. let's see. Any other questions? Do you have any other comments? Closing comments, Chair Lesh?
I appreciate your support. Where's it going again, Madam Chair?
This bill is getting late for possible inclusion. Okay. So I guess hearing no other discussions, that's what we'll do. We'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Judiciary Finance Bill. And it looks like, as far as notes, we have a meeting Monday evening at 5 o'clock or 15 minutes after floor session, and we've got two bills on the agenda for that day. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.